Strange, is it not, that we should be drinking together? Colonel Engels of the British Intelligence and Special Agent Kellerman of the Gestapo.
Yes, only one can't always choose one's company, can one?
That is life. You serve your country and I serve mine.
Yes, only you haven't got one left to serve, have you?
For the moment, it is true. There are many like me working all over the world, you know. We need funds. That's why I'm here. Germany is destroyed now, but one day she will be rebuilt. Our industry will again be the best in the world, and it'll be the same with our armed forces. One day, you can be sure, fascism will triumph again. We'll see to that. There'll be a new generation, thank heavens, who will have forgotten that war is horrible.
You're very frank.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's actually 5 o'clock on the dot, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 22nd of March 2024. So we're streaming live on the from the PRSC Arts Centre in Bristol, People's Republic of Stokes Croft, on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. Aurora Police rather than Google, and that actually works on Android phones, and you can get it on Apple phones, monopolistic Apple phones. We might be touching on that in a minute. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade propaganda psyops, the puff pieces on the conspirators and the hatchet jobs on the heroes, selling war rather than reading news. The McCarthyite witch hunts, going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity and against the World War III wage slavery lies. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, so-called solutions to every crisis, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, farming, cost of living, climate, stacking up nicely, aren't they? The twisted accelerationist Armageddonist policies, far right, of course, designed to make every crisis worse. And the politicians, as Manfred Petrich used to say, bless him, have nothing to say. Nick Land's behaviourist Dark Enlightenment drones, the cowards and control freaks, want us as slaves to their computers. Huxley's diabolical plan rewards only blind obedience, folks, and you're not allowed to get any sort of real education under his system. Meanwhile, pantheistic wife-murdering WEF King Tampon Charlie wages war on the British people as well as on China, Russia and the BRICS, with regime change maniac, sidekick and referendum failure Diddy David Cameron sitting next to him. So anyway, helping us navigate the WEF's Fourth Industrial Revolution, the Fourth Reich Matrix, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Marvin Rees, Bristol's mayor, his last big speech before he, gets a nice job at some sort of massive institution, as if he's been a fantastic mayor. This is rather like the European Union operates. So as opposition and government leaders are booted out because they're no good, they get snapped up, as Marvin may well do now, by the UN Habitat organization. We shall see. Handpicked policymakers, and this is how he works, how his speech is to an adoring handpicked audience. This is the way it works. You've got to have your mates there to clap you. No critics and no questions from critics. That's the way Marvin operates. And so it's his last big speech until he disappears. Last week it was actually at the Beacon Centre, which is what used to be called Colston Hall. So we'll be looking also at that Apple monopoly antitrust case. Neil Oliver interviewing George Galloway, rather entertaining. And drones. We look at drones in the first hour. We've just had an occupation up at the Elbit Systems headquarters. These are the Israeli drone company, which is in here in Bristol. And I also talked this week to Chris Cole from Drone Wars UK about this whole idea of Terminator drones, the idea that you can just turn a computer on, it's like a little kind of video game, and it plays itself. No human beings get involved, but a lot of human beings on the other end of this get themselves killed. We'll be looking at the dental contracts and also this thing called the New Deal for Nature, as well as there we've got a couple of interesting documentaries. We've got a couple from on the 11th of October. in part two, Mad Max in Haiti, and the United Nations Security Council's voting today voted against the ceasefire. This is actually China and Russia this time saying it wasn't realistic. So poor old Gaza just carries on, doesn't it? Also, a special investigation tonight into the Hampstead case of child ritual abuse, child satanic abuse, many call it. And there's been a lot of, there was a documentary on Channel 4 a couple of weeks ago about this, or a week or so ago. And but there's no Sabine McNeil, who was accused and put in prison for 4 years for trying to expose this. She wasn't given any kind of writer reply on there, so she's going to get a writer reply tonight. I managed to track her down in Germany, so we'll be hearing from her. Also, Andrew Lowney, the Mountbatten Diaries. He had to spend £500,000 to get the University of Southampton to publish these diaries from Mountbatten that were private diaries. Even though the state had paid the university to acquire these diaries, they wouldn't allow anyone to have a look at them, and he managed to force them to do that. We're hearing from him. He also wrote a book, by the way, it's not just on Mountbatten, called The Traitor King, on Edward VIII. Fascinating guy. And also on vaccines and about the vaccine rollout, we'll have a chat to Hedley Reese, who is one of those people that looks at the very few people around that looks at the actual quality control in the vaccine industry. What a job Hedley's got. So it's time, I suppose, to have the Iranian and Russian news banned in the UK. Maybe other news is going to be banned soon too. First by the telecoms cartel and then by Ofcom. But us also cancelled off of Bristol Community FM, our regular show for 12, 13 years by the Bristol Mafia and the boss there, Pat Hart, but not cancelled here yet. Anyway, so Martin, should we maybe start with the prosaic issue of dental contracts, because there was bit by bit, we had a big story in Bristol recently, didn't we, about an NHS dentist opening with 3 or 4 days of queues around the block for people to try and join it.
Well, that's right. I mean, if people don't think that the National Health Service is under threat, the fact is that many people are unable to get an NHS dentist, and even when you do, you can't get the treatment you wanted at the price, you know, for free, which was guaranteed in the original National Health Service promise. And of course, teeth are not just cosmetic. If you look at the medical records from the early modern era, you will see that one of the most common forms of death, they just put teeth. Because, of course, rotten teeth, if they're not dealt with properly, can kill you.
How do rotten teeth kill you? That sounds
because
silly.
Through sepsis. Don't forget they had no antibiotics.
Okay. So do you clean your teeth every day, every morning,
yes.
Every evening?
Yes.
And I know you were telling me just before we came on air that you need to go to a dentist.
I do.
You're having trouble finding one.
I've not been registered at a dentist for years, and I don't know how to go about registering. It's a nightmare for many people. Of course, what then happens is you get an emergency and you have to go privately and then spend whatever you've got to spend on it, if you can. And, of course, many people can't. George Monbiot, one of your favourite people, has written some quite good articles in The Guardian about this.
Yeah, well, it's one of those easy things to write about. He hasn't written anything about Gaza, and he hasn't written anything about Julian Assange.
Well, indeed.
Has he? So this is what we call a limited hangout. Anyway, so yes, of course, dental contracts have been a total disaster deliberately. I don't know if you remember, this is about 6 or 7 years, maybe even more ago. I think it was even at the time of the new Cameron Clegg government. So that would be more like, 13 years ago. 12 years ago or so, we had Tamsin Cave and we had a certain David Miller's organisation, Spinwatch, looking at this whole issue of all of the private healthcare lobbying firms all around the Westminster Parliament, all down Whitehall, all around that area. There are these companies that do nothing else but pay individuals fantastic amounts of money to lobby for the private healthcare industry.
Well, that's right. And of course, it's been a scare tactic, if you like, by the Labour Party at every election for years. The NHS isn't safe in Tory hands, and it clearly isn't. if you actually look at their internal discussions, it's quite clear that they've always hated the health service and the whole concept of it, and they've worked very hard to undermine it. And of course, that was also continued by Labour governments, who continued the whole process of internal marketisation, which isn't real anyway, it's just a farce. All of it's paid for by the government at the end of the day. Well, in the case of the dental care, they simply won't pay the amount of money required for the dentists to do the job and make a profit. Therefore, quite logically, from their own point of view, they've moved into private practice where they can make a profit.
I was reading that there's £25 million sitting in the dental budget, unspent and unused, because there's so little money to be made by these NHS dental contracts that for many dentists it's simply not worth their while.
That's right,
to be putting people through the system. It doesn't make them enough to pay their staff and the dentist.
Well, that's right. And the government basically doesn't want to pay for free dental care for people, because there's some loads more important things to pay for, like the war in the Ukraine, bailing the banks out, and the money spent on PPE by the
Tories.
This was
all part of the post World War II deal, wasn't it?
That's right. And in fact, Nye Bevan, when he was a Labour minister in the 1950s, as part of the infighting that was going on, the Labour government wanted to introduce payments for spectacles, like you'd have to pay a shilling or something to buy some spectacles. And he resigned from the government, and they said, look, it's only a shilling, most people can afford a shilling. He said, it's the principle of the thing. Once you start charging people, then the principle of charging will come back. The whole principle of NHS dentistry used to be that you will get free dentistry. Now, of course, the way they finesse this is say, well, dentistry is largely cosmetic, and that's the sort of thing people have got to pay for. But lots of basic dentistry isn't cosmetic, and you've got to pay for it. If people are going to get it free, the government has to pay for it. But, of course, they've now created a situation where many people simply can't get an NHS dentist. If they have the resources and they've got terrible toothache, they go private. And once they've done that, they never go back to the NHS
again.
What?
I also think it's something to do with 2008. The government is saying, well, we've just got less and less and less to spend. So they justify it to themselves because they've got all these massive debt repayments because they bailed out the banks, that they just say, oh, well, there's just not enough money.
Well, it's the magic monetary argument, isn't it? We've got no money because we've wasted it all on other stuff.
And other things.
Therefore, there isn't
any. Well, the other stuff also includes Stephen Hester, by the way, who we were chatting about last week, the Tory donor who thinks that Diane Abbott should be shot. You know, how much do you have to pay to be a racist in Britain without getting annoyed? And it looks like he actually may be prosecuted after this big hoo-ha. Maybe. It turns out that he had been... I mean, we were discussing this a bit last week, weren't we? This is how the modern NHS works. It's just a kind of cash cow for mates of the Tories. So he's giving them £15 million. In exchange, the Department for Health has given him contracts to do software to manage patient records in the National Health Service. When I wonder if that's secure, who knows, but he's managed to build up over a few years. He's managed to build up £1 billion company. So a little bit of that billion,
money.
Yes, with our money.
Money,
it's our money. He's managed to build that company up worth £1 billion now. So he's saying thank you very much to the Tory Party for renewing those contracts and making them so very nice for me, where I can make massive amounts of profit. I'm going to give you £15 million reward, but actually that's peanuts in terms of what he's actually made.
Well, that's right, but you can see what happened with the Dido Harding and the test and trace stuff was that all the people were wearing NHS logos on their jackets, but it was a private company that were given the contract. And the Tories can accept the existence of the NHS as long as it's all contracted out to their chums. Now, the whole point of having a National Health Service is that you've got a monopsony buyer for the pharmaceutical companies, so you can just say to the pharmaceutical companies, we're buying at this price, and, you know, that's the price it's going to be, so you could cut them down to size. And you could also basically... But why doesn't the National Health Service, a national institution covering the whole of the country, why hasn't it got its own internal IT people? Why haven't you got your own internal IT people? So when you need to do IT stuff, you just tell them, get on with it.
I may be a bit of a peasant, but I've never met or known anyone called Dido. Have you?
Well, there is Dido Harding.
Have you ever met or known anyone?
Well, no, it's
physically, face to face.
The name of a goddess in Virgil's Aeneid.
Dido was one of the kings of Carthage.
Dido was the queen of Carthage in a story written by Virgil. and that's why it's a sort of posh name, really, Dido. Yeah. But on the other hand, anybody calls themselves all sorts of things these days.
The Carthaginians were head choppers. The Carthaginians practiced child sacrifice. Is this a really cool thing to call your kid, Dido? Anyway, if you really wanted to know a bit of rather than the silly anecdotes from us about Dido Harding and the whole COVID thing, go to the 2020 Bilderberg page on WikiSpooks, and you'll find that amazing list of 120 key people involved in the whole COVID pandemic who were, in fact, Bilderbergers from every level, right the way through to from government ministers to policymakers to technology owning companies, they're all there. That's who did it. They did it. The Bilderbergers. Anyway, look, back to dentists, and Sean Charlwood is the boss of the General Dental Council, and here is his response to the latest government proposal to adjust the dental contract.
I am, as always, very grateful to this committee for this opportunity to present the profession's perspective on that question and on what is happening in NHS dentistry. And as you say, your report remains an instruction manual to save NHS dentistry. The government has, I'm afraid, given the impression that it's willing to skip over your first and most fundamental recommendation, and that, of course, is contract reform. Mm-hmm. And my colleagues are grateful that you continue to keep the pressure up on the department, behind the scenes, in the chamber, and in the form of today's session. And I'll be honest, having sat in negotiations for many months, my expectations of the recovery plan were pretty low. We waited nearly a year for this document, and my worry then was that with every day that passed, more colleagues would pare down their NHS commitment or walk away entirely. And now it's landed, I'm afraid there's really nothing here to bring this service back from the brink and deliver the promise that was made. But I didn't want to come here and just offer opinions. What we have done is surveyed the membership so that we can give you some facts. And having spoken to countless colleagues, the sense of disappointment and, frankly, resentment in the profession is profound. We surveyed, as I say, members. We wanted their feedback on this recovery plan today. And we were taken aback, frankly, by how brutal that feedback was. Government has told this committee, as you say, Chair, that its objective is to provide NHS care to all who need it. Well, we asked dentists if they thought the plan was capable of keeping that promise. 1% agreed. 1 in 100 respondents thought that this plan could deliver that promise, to answer your question directly. Just 3% said the measures in the plan would keep them providing NHS care in the long term. 3%. And most damningly, dentists don't believe that this will improve access for patients. Only 3% believe that this plan will result in their practice seeing more NHS patients. Almost half believe it will do the exact opposite, and lead to their practice seeing fewer NHS patients. Not fewer existing patients to make space for those who haven't been seen, fewer patients overall. And to conclude, we also asked our members to sum up the plan in their own words, and this gives you a sense of the emotion of it. We didn't offer any prompts. Free text. What we got was unambiguous. Cold fury from colleagues who have given up hope, frankly, of change. I read the words too little, too late over 100 times in responses. We counted the phrases used most often. They were, I quote, not fit for purpose, dishonest, inadequate, rubbish, and I'm sorry to say, a joke. It's a pretty good summary of what the profession makes of this plan. It feels to me that this plan was not designed to rescue NHS dentistry. It was designed with the upcoming election in mind to try and limit the political damage the access crisis is doing to political prospects in constituencies. The measures in the plan make for a good press release, a nice photo opportunity, or something for candidates to talk about on the doorstep. But this recovery plan, to be honest, is not worthy of the title. The fundamental perversity of this system remains unchallenged. One colleague, to conclude, commented that you cannot rebuild a collapsed wall with a box of polyfiller. And that's precisely what is sadly being attempted here once again. more papering over of cracks rather than the decisive and fundamental reform that you, your committee, recommended to deliver care to the millions of your constituents who can't access NHS dental care.
Well, that was at the Health Select Committee earlier this week, who he praised. That was Sean Charlwood there, boss of the General Dental Council, praising the committee for doing what they could with the Department for Health. But it's quite obvious that they're getting absolutely nowhere, Martin. What they've been getting from the government and what we're getting as members of the public and the press is BS promises. So in other words, a promise that they've got no intention of keeping, and just lies, public relations.
Well, that's right. I mean, the damage is largely done, isn't it?
They've also broken the morale of dentistry, from what he's saying.
That's right. But they've also broken people's trust that they're going to get dental care, which then leads to them, if they have got the resources, going private.
Pulling out their own teeth and things like this.
Well, I mean, that's already happening. I mean, this is one of the most advanced countries in the world. And, you know, this is the sort of thing that we thought, you know, when in the 1960s when I was growing up, it was quite clear that healthy teeth were taken very seriously. We had people coming into school to check our teeth when we were in school. We had regular checkups. And, you know, if any problems were identified, they were dealt with promptitude. And we've now got, you know, basically a privatised dental system where wealthy people can get dental care and poor people, and that's maybe a third of the population, simply can't get their teeth looked after, which, of course, has long-term health implications. For all, you know, teeth are not just a sort of cosmetic add-on. They're a fundamental part of your physical anatomy. Just because dentists are not the same as doctors doesn't mean that they're not as important. People can and do die from having poor dental health.
Well, and also the whole healthcare system seems to be being utterly controlled and swamped by these Fourth Reich pharmaceutical companies, which are just predating, trying to make people ill. Yes. And actually making profits from...
loads of people will be taking loads of painkillers for dental work, you know, for dental pain, which they should also have been dealt with.
There are some people that talk about chemtrails. I'm not one of them. Apparently, they're spraying all this stuff around to make us ill so that they can then make money out of us. But I don't think they need to spray all the stuff up in the sky or anything like that.
People get ill quite naturally. As long as you don't care for them, then they get even more ill, don't they?
The main idea seems to be, let's do everything we can to get people hooked on a drug that actually ultimately won't make them better.
Well, that's true of the pharmaceutical companies, but ultimately, talking about the overall strategy is to get rid of socialistic ideas like free healthcare. And once you've got rid of it, it's very difficult to bring it back. It was only brought in at the end of the Second World War because of the extreme circumstances of the war. And, once people have got used to paying for their dental care, they're going to resent paying taxes for other people to have dental care when they've got to pay themselves. There'll be a two-tier system, basically.
Well, something
rather... People with money will have to go privately, and then those people won't be very happy to pay for others because they'll say, well, I've paid for my dental care already. Why should I pay for other people's
dental care? It sounds like the United States, isn't it?
Well, exactly, and even more like Latin America.
Yeah.
And, of course, they've never had any socialistic medicine apart from in Cuba.
In the terms of healthcare, something quite a little bit good happened. Penny Mordaunt this week announced that Andrew Bridgen is going to get his vaccine debate as one of the few MPs that managed to get a debate middle end of April sometime, and so we'll be keeping an eye on that when it happens. That should be interesting. You'll probably find it when he starts to speak, all of the other MPs that think the pharmaceutical industry is wonderful will walk out of the chamber or something. But anyway, he's been an absolutely brilliant stalwart, bringing up people like Asima Malhotra and many other doctors who have been criticising the efficacy of the vaccines and the COVID vaccine specifically I'm talking about, the jabs. But anyway, Hedley Rees is Welsh. I spoke to him last week about GlaxoSmithKline, and he's managed to do a lot of digging around the whole vaccine rollout, only to find that almost all the people that were in charge of it making these decisions very, very close to government and brought by government onto the committees are either at the time or in their past careers were senior people in Big Pharma, or else have gone straight into Big Pharma jobs afterwards. So let's have a listen to Hedley Rees now.
After Kate Bingham, who was initial chair of the Vaccine Task Force in the UK, reported to Boris Johnson, Sir Richard Sykes took over the chair in 2020-21, and he was the CEO of Glaxo, which was the forerunner to Glaxo Welcome, which was the forerunner to GlaxoSmithKline. And Sir Richard Sykes masterminded those two mega mergers, and he was the chair of the vaccine task force. Working with him was Sir Ian McCubbin, who was, again, a long-term VP of supply chain for GSK. I met him in 2012. And between those two and another GSK board member in the US, a guy called Sal Wee, forget his first name, a 30-year employee of GSK, he was advisor to Donald Trump on the Warp Speed project. So you had GSK executives actually masterminding the entire global rollout of the vaccines. MHRA, the former CEO of MHRA before Jim Rain was a guy called Dr. Ian Hudson, and he joined the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in 2019. So he is effectively running MHRA even today. And Bill Gates obviously is working behind the scenes with UK government. We're getting them excited about what these vaccines can do for the UK. UK government have had, they want to be number one in life sciences in the world. And they've been working on this since the year 2001, when the UK government started meetings with big pharma companies. Sir Richard Sykes was at the first meeting in 2021. And ever since, they've been working together in a you help me and I'll help you. So the UK government has been wanting the pharmaceutical industry to make it number one in life sciences so that it can prove that, we're a major force in the world.
Okay, so it sounds like a bit of a tug of war going on. So you've got the pharmaceutical industry being courted by government. So the government is supposed to be there representing the patients, people who are ultimately going to have these drugs, and yet it seems that in a way they are doffing the cap of the public to the pharmaceutical industry because they're desperate to have a very, very successful biotech industry.
Absolutely. You've summarized that superbly.
So you mentioned, I think, was it Welcome there?
The Welcome Trust and Jeremy Farrar.
Yeah, because, didn't you say that GSK were originally partly part of Welcome?
Yeah, the way they actually bought, they were Glaxo. Glaxo started as a company making milk powders, and they moved more into pharmaceuticals. And there was a separate company called Welcome, and Glaxo acquired Welcome in the late 1980s.
The reason I mentioned Welcome Trust is because I've got a personal interest. We used to go. I went to school at my secondary school, and it was a grammar school. Was Langley Park in southeast London near Beckenham in Kent, West Wickham area. And that next door to our school was a great big place called Langley Court, which was then known as Burroughs Welcome, which was the research headquarters for something called the Welcome Trust. That's spelt with two L's, by the way, yeah. Double L. And yeah. As school kids, when we were sort of 13, 14 years old, we used to joke in the on the school playing field when we were out messing around at lunchtime about the cows with two heads next door, and in fact, there was a big tower, like a giant water tower, and a chimney next to this beautiful old country house. Very incongruous, actually, to see the giant water tower and the chimney. And at school, we used to joke that when they created some sort of genetic monstrosity in there, that they would first of all try and flush it down the drain using the giant water tower. And if it wouldn't go down the drain, they'd stick it in the incinerator and burn it in the chimney. And we also used to point at the chimney sometimes when you see smoke coming out. So that was right next door to where I went to secondary school. And the Wellcome Trust is, seems to me, very similar to this thing in the United States, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So, you know, these kind of so-called charitable foundations in the States are similar to the charitable trust in Britain, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. And we know the head of Wellcome Trust had just moved to be chief scientific officer at the World Health Organization. So how about that for revolving doors?
I mean, he was Jeremy Farrar was in charge of SAGE, I think, wasn't it? Over here?
Initially he was on SAGE, and then, you know, and the thing is, they're working behind the scenes, even if you're not seeing them on committees. They may duck and dive, but they're working behind the scenes. And I've got documentation that says that SAGE was meeting with the pharmaceutical manufacturers in 2015. So
interesting, isn't it, that they don't really need to meet with them? They are them.
Yes, I suppose you could say that.
And yeah. What about the MHRA? Because they're supposed to regulate all this. We saw June Rain with her kind of slightly twisted smile approving these vaccines, saying they're all fantastic. Well, we know that they've been involved in various scandals. One of the most recent ones was the mesh, which has been implanted in mostly into women and also some into men as well, which turned out to be a complete and utter disaster. And yet that was all approved by the MHRA.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a shell organization. The evaluation of new drugs moved to the European Medicines Agency in 1995. So MHRA has never evaluated the drug application ever since. They don't have the skills. What they're doing is just pretending that they do have the skills and just waving these things through. The number of freedom of information requests that have gone into MHRA, you could paper, you know, 1,000 walls with. It's unbelievable. But so, and I attended an MHRA symposium. Kindly UK column pays me to do that, on good distribution practice, and it was horrific. And I've recorded these as well. They were saying that they suspended quality control during the vaccines being developed and produced by adopting what they call shipping under quarantine. Though that means you can ship from one manufacturer to the next, even though it hadn't been quality controlled. So the shipping site hadn't quality controlled it. Now, the idea would be that when the other company gets it, they hold it until they've been informed that it has been passed, and then they can release it. But of course, these companies don't talk to each other. The chance of them holding it would have been, you know, zilch. So effectively, these materials are going all over the world with no quality control. And I was listening to what they were saying, you know, and I co-chaired a conference in Cincinnati from 2011 to 2014, which was FDA co-sponsored. And MHRA speakers, we had them every year, and they were good quality, you know, inspectors and senior managers. Now, they're just kids there. They're just youngsters, or, you know, the people who decided to stay on and just, you know, take the money, if you like.
Well, it sounds to me like the media studies CSE students you get on the BBC today, Lee. Can you just say something about the role of things like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Wellcome Trust, though? Because, I mean, they're slightly separate to the industry itself. They are these charitable foundations, but they've also made a lot of money out of this. They're supposed to be charities, but one questions what their whether they've really got proper charitable aims.
Oh, well, in 2011, Bill and Melinda Gates employed a guy called Trevor Mundell, who was the head of R&D for Novartis in Switzerland. Now, Novartis, the company I mentioned, that launched the first gene therapy for blood cancers in the US. It was approved by FDA in 2017. Now, so Mundell has been working since 2011 with Bill and Melinda Gates to just get gene therapies integrated into the whole narrative about the future of health and people and that whole thing. Now,
okay, does it work? This gene therapy, does it actually work?
No. Well, the FDA have just, the only gene therapy that's out there at the moment is what they call a CAR T therapy, which is for rare blood cancers. And the FDA have just put a warning. There's 6 on the market, and the FDA made them all put a severe warning on the labeling to say this can cause, it can cause neurological toxicities, cytokine release syndrome, and all sorts of other things. So FDA always was the gold standard in regulatory. And what's happened is the CDC and Bill Gates and those have sidelined the FDA over this period. So that, and the guy at FDA, a guy called Peter Marks, is the head of all the approvals of the biologics drugs. And Peter Marks has just given evidence in Congress in the US, and he's had difficulty answering the questions there. So, but I think that is, people are waking up at FDA, and they are now really beginning to stamp their authority on this. So they've put these warnings on these CAR-T therapies, which means gene therapies are not going to sell, basically because they can kill people.
So there's Hedley Rees, Mr. Quality Control, giving us a really good idea of some of these pharmaceutical products coming down the pipeline, Martin.
Yeah, well, he's obviously done his homework, hasn't he, that guy? I mean, the pharmaceutical companies have always been wronged actors, in my view. Developing countries have been pushing for years, for example, to develop generic drugs, which, you know, because once you've established what a drug is and what it can do, you don't really need to, you can produce it quite cheaply. It's all the research that costs the money. But of course, in all of these trade negotiations that go on, the pharmaceutical companies insist that their patents for these drugs must be protected, which is essentially a way of exploiting poor, ill people. And that's one of the reasons why, in fact, the whole pharmaceutical industry should be nationalised, like many other industries. Not all industries, but pharmaceutical industry, why not?
What about what you're saying about Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Wellcome Trust? These organisations seem to be almost like super industry lobbying bodies. The idea is that they're taking a very long view, maybe 50, 100 years into the future. They're manipulating regulation and regulatory policy to make sure that whatever the pharmaceutical industry is planning for 20, 30 years down the line, it all gets very well received by the regulators.
Well, that's right. It's basically a bit bait and switch, isn't it? So they're making money already by exploiting the public. They then use that money to set up a charitable foundation, which then says all the things they want it to say. And as I say, the only way to really deal with this is the socialization of the production of medicines, so that there is no profit motive. They're just produced because, and the assessment of whether they're going to work or not is truly objective. And of course, you can still make mistakes in a socialised system, but you don't have the conflict of interest problem which you've got with pharmaceutical companies, who are basically illness companies rather than health companies, aren't they?
They certainly are.
That's what they do.
Yeah. Well, I wonder about government as well. The whole idea of government, I'm not quite sure. You may know who the philosopher was that said that government is the shadow cast over society by big business.
Well, I don't know who said that. I mean, the question is, what government have you got? I mean, during the COVID crisis, the Cubans, communist system, they produced 4 of their own vaccines in Cuba. They didn't have anything to do with pharmaceutical companies because they're under sanctions. They have been since 1959. And, you know, they got through it. But they got through it by doing it their own way without cooperating with these people in any way whatsoever.
Okay, so let's go to Bristol now, and the big final speech at the Bristol Beacon, used to be called the Colston Hall, and of course, giving the speech there, our marvellous Marvin the Marvellous, the Mayor, he was, I suppose, almost had to say something about the whole Colston business, Martin. How do you think he's dealt with all that? You know, the Colston statue being dragged into the harbour, this great, so-called great and good of Bristol, dunked by the people.
Well, as George Ferguson, who used to be the mayor of Bristol before Marvin Rees, said, he thought that it was easier for Marvin to deal with it because he was, he got a West Indian family background. And he also tried to take a middle road, saying, well, I don't approve of people throwing things in the drink, but then it's in there now, so let's move on. And, of course, that probably did, to some extent, allow the situation to be managed.
We heard a bit of accelerationism just a little while ago, didn't we, from the General Dental Council saying, well, actually, the crisis in dental care is being made worse by this government. That's called accelerationism, folks. And deliberately, of course, in order to create more and more of a crisis, demoralise the public, punish the public, hostile environment for the public, and particularly for the poorer people. But anyway, we got a similar kind of thing from Marvin Rees. I was really surprised to see him actually saying things like, I prefer... I was reminded very much of Keir Starmer, Martin, last year on Newsnight, when he said, oh, I prefer the World Economic Forum to Westminster. I think it's a much better way to do things. And Marvin is saying a very similar thing here in Bristol. He doesn't really like the democratic process, even though he supposedly got elected in a democratic system. Actually, no, it was the Labour Party's apparatchiks that appointed him over the heads of many people who've been working in the Labour Party for many years here in Bristol, including the actual leader of the Labour group on the City Council. Helen Holland, she was completely passed over and wasn't even in the running. So they set him against Mark Bradshaw, the guy with the stutter, very nice chap, but not exactly much of a go-getter. And Marvin won, and that meant that he became mayor and took over everything. So it wasn't a very democratic process at all. But anyway, in his speech at the Bristol Beacon, I was shocked to hear, really, really, I mean, shocked is one of those words you never use, according to Kevin Hoyle, and he's right, to say that he prefers the mentioned venturers over Black Lives Matter, which is a bizarre thing to say. I mean, maybe he's just trying to do a Jeremy Corbyn, Martin, and include everybody, including the super rich elite here in Bristol, the local Illuminati.
Well, I don't know what he actually said, so I don't really want to comment I've actually heard
very
it.
Very wise of you as a Labour member, yeah. And the other thing he said was he prefers the groups that protested at the Cenotaph, which I think was Tommy Robinson and the EDL, over the Colston Four. Anyway, listen to what he's got to say here. Well, it's not unbelievable. It's the sort of gobbledygook I suppose you'd expect from someone who's a groomed politician who's got nothing to do with democracy whatsoever. A Yale World Fellow, friend of Alexei Navalny.
About 1987, myself and four friends, Dean, Marcus, Mark and Jason, went to a party in a church, youth club, at Zion Chapel on Coronation Road. Now, we knew we were in the wrong part of town. We were 15-year-old black teenagers. We'd gone south of the river. And afterwards, we were walking home, and we got to the bottom of Redcliffe Hill, and a group of about a dozen older white men started shouting racial abuse at us. I said, hello. I literally did say, all right, mate. And then they said, get them. And then they chased us. And I have no doubt, for those of you that know Bristol's reputation for violence in the 1980s, that if they'd have caught us, we'd have been in very serious trouble. That kind of sense of physical threat and abuse was not unusual growing up in Bristol in the 80s. And for my forebears, my elders, who had to deal with that in the 60s and 70s, it would have been worse. And then throw forward to 2012, and this is a story of healing. I'm in Lawrence Weston, campaigning to be mayor. I knock on a door. It opens, and a big guy, a white guy, opens the door. Tattooed arms, shaved head. My early warning kicked in, and I presumed the worst. And you know what he said to me? I'm voting for you. You're one of us. And I will share that my experience in the city through race and class, through that prism, has left me with a number of interesting reflections. And one is a sense of belief in the authenticity of some members of the merchant venturers that is greater than that I've seen in some of the noisiest anti-racist and social justice activists in the city. And it's left me with a feeling, a greater sense of connection with some of the Cenotaph counter-protesters than I did with the Colston Four. Now, I stress feeling, because that reaction, my journey around race and class, it's not something I've chosen. It's natural and it's been involuntary, a product of a shared story within the city. Now, when we came into office, we came in with a commitment to get things done. Now, the truth is that delivery is a tightrope for politicians, because when you deliver, it means making changes. And when you make changes, it means political conflict. And there is a path of least resistance open to politics that says do little and avoid controversy. Stay away from housing delivery. Stay away from big transport solutions. Focus on making announcements, pushing gimmicks, exploiting photo opportunities, then blame the government and other outside forces for ongoing social challenges. But that serves the politician rather than the people we came in to make a difference for.
Well, the irony, of course, is there's been virtually nothing in the way of housing or transport that he's delivered. But much more importantly, his comments there, Martin, what do you make of that on the merchant venturers and the social justice campaigners like the Black Lives Matter, and then the right-wing people like the EDL turning up at the Cenotaph? Maybe that's the Bristol one he's referring to, maybe the London one, who knows?
I think it's the Bristol
one. Well, maybe it is, but, you know, saying that he's got more in common with them than with the Colston for a bizarre thing to say.
Well, I think what he did during that whole his whole time in office is he's tried to to deal with conflicts by trying to show that he understands various points of view. The merchant venturers, I understand your point of view.
He prefers them. That's what he was saying.
Well, he said, in some ways, I prefer them, is what he's saying. And of course, in actual fact, what he's doing is classical, mealy-mouthed politician speak. You know, I'm trying to be everything to everybody. Yeah. I mean, of course, you quite rightly point out, I mean, you know, if we're going to judge it on the results in things like transport and housing, well, it's been pretty mediocre, hasn't it, say the least?
Nothing.
Yeah, but that's because...
Well, actually, no, not just nothing. Transport has got far, far worse.
All right, well, what I've always felt about Marvin when he first... I mean, don't forget, he has got quite an interesting background, as you've uncovered in this programme years ago. His father was indeed a major gangster, but he was brought up by his mother, who's a Welsh nursery nurse. And, you know, he certainly didn't go to the posh schools people like Cameron and Blair.
It's important just to tease out the, you know, the key facts around that business of Valentine Walker, who was proprietor of this blues club called the Crystal Dove on Grosvenor Road, the front line at the time. And that was that Valentine was accused of actually attacking with a machete. In fact, she initially came in with a gun, then came back with a machete and tried to kill the leader of the anti-apartheid movement. And I always remember Steve Norman saying to me, well, this is one of the greatest miscarriages of justice, because he got off. He hardly even turned to court, came into court, and he got off. And the anti-apartheid guy had to get away, get out of the city, because obviously someone had nearly killed him. In fact, he very nearly did kill him. And nothing was done about it. So he eventually ended up going to Ghana, where he's very happy, and we interviewed him and spoke to him. And he's one of the main spokespeople and trainers of the Ghanaian national football team now.
That's right. And of course, he was on the show from Ghana, and he also came back to Bristol, and we had a meeting with him here at the Malcolm X Centre.
Well, what Steve Norman said to me, very interesting, I think, and you'll find this out there, I'm sure, somewhere. Steve, the long-time ex-merchant seaman campaigner, is Marvin, has got where he is today because of what his dad did for the establishment. And the establishment in Bristol was extremely happy that the anti-apartheid movement had been so really deftly nobbled by Valentine Walker, allegedly. So,
Tony Balagoon, who the person you're talking about, he made it absolutely clear in his speech at the Malcolm X Centre.
He supported Marvin.
Yes, he said he was a little boy at the time, and it was nothing to do with him.
He wasn't.
And none
he
of
was,
this should
yeah,
be
well,
seen.
He was brought up by his mother. He was,
which is why my other half knows his mother. Because her daughter went to the nursery school that she went to.
I'm just quoting Steve.
And she's known Marvin since she was a little boy.
Quoting Steve Norman.
Yes, but Steve Norman doesn't know Marvin necessarily, does he? He doesn't know the family. He doesn't know the background.
He had, for example, Steve had been chatting to ex-police and saying that the detectives have said that Valentine was a police informer, as Balagoon himself alleged.
I'm sure that was the case. But was Marvin Rees, aged 6 years old, responsible for that? And the answer is no, he wasn't. He went... basically, he had very little to do with his father. When I first met Marvin Rees, I was drinking on the front line down here, and I was talking to people, said he's running for mayor. He'll be the first black mayor, elected black mayor in Western Europe if he wins. I said, who is he? Never heard of him. I said, and I saw Marvin later in the afternoon, and I said, I was just been drinking down the front line, and they don't even know you're running. Yeah. And he took me aside and he said, if they knew who my father was, they'd know exactly who I am, because my second name, Rees, is my mother's name. If I'd said Walker, they'd know who I was. He said, I don't make a secret of it, and I don't want to blast it from the rooftops.
No.
But my father was indeed a gangster.
Anyway,
he went on to study and go to college, and he's involved in the church, Tony, the church.
Yes,
and
he wanted
to be an army officer, and he's very, very close to the police. In actual fact, he's liked by the establishment because he's pro-establishment,
okay, Martin,
not because of his father.
You're not letting me speak anything any way here. When you talk about the church, we had Dia Moodley on speaking last week, who does preach in the city centre. He's a Christian preacher on a Saturday, and he said, Marvin came past, he said, we don't want your kind of Christian in this city. So is that a very churchy thing to say?
Well, it's as churchy as you'll find in Northern Ireland, I tell you.
Well, it's that's not, the reality it's not of Christianity, Northern Ireland, Tony. Well, it isn't really, no. It's the reality of fake Christianity. Mm. Marvin Rees, also in that same speech, he did a little chit-chat afterwards with the guy that was interviewing him, David Olungoza, who's some sort of media type. But anyway, they did this very nice manicured conversation after he'd done his speech, where he said this.
So I went to New York just after I was elected, and I met Michael Berkovitz. He was head of the Rockefeller Foundation, Resilient Cities. Michael had worked for Mike Bloomberg, and I was out with Mike. I was feeling a bit overwhelmed. He said, Marvin, he said, no, that's normal. He said, our first year in office, it felt like having our mouths around a fire hydrant. I thought, if this guy was with Mike Bloomberg and they felt like that, it's okay for me to feel like that. And I think that tsunami of decisions and pressures and things that seem to have been saved up from before the election landing on me caused me to squeeze the time I probably would have liked, should have invested in visiting other city leaders and seeing how they structure themselves and how they do things. So we just got straight on the treadmill. Bang, right, you've got to do this, got to do that. And that was a challenge. I think I would have been more structured in my time. Rather than just bouncing off of what came in, I should have said, this is my time to be in the gym, this is my time to do this at home, and so forth. I'm not very good at building structure, which is a problem, and I should have done that, you know, at the beginning, made life a lot more predictable around me. In terms of issues in the city, that's what you're really asking, right? Where do I now find myself on the side of an argument I wish I didn't have? That's a difficult one. Because it's not as though there are any overt failures. It's stages of, you know, it's degrees of success that we've dealt with. I wish we'd have seen sooner that some of the changes we wanted to happen within the council weren't actually being implemented. Right? I won't mention the departments, but there are delivery and there are impacts and there are services that were being delivered in a different way if the piece of work we commissioned at the beginning had actually been done. And people haven't been pretending to have done it. And I wish we'd have had a tighter grip on that.
Marvin Rees, thank you very much for answering all our questions. Thank you all for coming here this evening.
So that's David Olsunga interviewing Marvin
Olsaga. Academic.
Okay, he's a filmmaker as well, apparently.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about him then.
Well, he's been quite a lot on the BBC because he's done all the history investigations of things like the slave trade, because he was one of the academics who were involved in tracing the people who were paid off for owning slaves. And quite a lot of, as you might imagine, quite a lot of wealthy people in the country today made their fortune from slavery, and it's all there in black and white in the research that he's done.
A bit of management gobbledygook at the end, and then after his great big long pause. I mean, I don't know, I find it very difficult. It's a bit like listening to Nick Land trying to actually make out what he's talking about. It seems to sort of be a whole load of almost randomly generated words, and at the end of the sentence you think, well, what on earth was that about?
Well, he's trying to justify his time in office, isn't he? like most people, he thinks he did a reasonable job, and of course he didn't get everything done he wanted to do, and that's what most people would say if they'd been running a city. It's most likely what he would say.
Well, I wouldn't say anything like that, neither would you. Annie Stafford Townsend, I think, would call it a word salad.
Well, I mean, Marvin comes in for a lot of criticism, word salads and all the rest.
It's not just criticism. It's the entire... He has managed to make the entire mayor system rejected by the Bristol people.
Well, it was rejected in a referendum which less than 50% of the population voted in, as in the referendum to have a mayor in the first place.
More voted to get rid of him than voted to have him.
Yes, but it's still less than 50% of the electorate.
That doesn't matter. That's the way it works. No one even forces you to go and vote.
Maybe you should be forced to vote in those referendums.
Maybe you should be forced to vote in those elections.
In Australia, you would be.
Yeah, but you're not here, so it doesn't matter how many people vote.
No, I'm just saying that the idea that many people have, even now, Tony, have got a fairly vague idea of who he is and what he stands for.
Not everybody is politically engaged.
That's right. They're not.
Some people have never even heard of the United Nations.
Well, that's right. That's true. Yes. And, you know, people who listen to this show and us, when we're anoraks, this is the sort of thing we care about. Lots of people have got other things on their minds. But maybe they shouldn't, but they do. I mean, he's just being self-justificatory there. You know, he got re-elected twice as the mayor of Bristol. Enough people voted for him to win both times. The first time he won outright. The second time he won on transfer votes. And of course,
and both times he voted really, or he was elected in really on the back of Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, you could argue that, yes, because in actual fact, most of
people
the Labour.
Voted Labour. Voted Labour, not Marvin.
They did. I totally agree with that. That's absolutely true. And therefore, criticism of Marvin is really by the by, because most people vote in local elections, even in local elections.
I hate to break it to you, Martin,
on their national loyalties. That's what we do on this show.
We criticise politicians all the time.
That's right.
When George Ferguson was mayor, we were criticising him. And at least he had the courage to come and face us.
Marvin's advice from Slocum and his other media team was to avoid getting into arguments with people and just concentrate on doing...
This is corporate PR. Well, it's not public stuff. He was talking about we just now, wasn't he? He was saying we got elected, we arrived in power. But actually, the whole point is it's him. It's not we.
Yes, I know, but as you just pointed out, we means the Labour Party. People voted for him because he was a fairly personable-looking Labour candidate, and there was nothing more to it than that. They voted Labour because they don't like the Tories.
I totally agree. Anyway, we went to a fascinating talk on Monday, which was called... It was to do with the English Civil War, about the various different sieges of Bristol. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about what happened in the English Civil War? This is in the 17th century. I think Bristol started off as royalists, was occupied by the...
It started off as parliamentary, trying to be neutral.
Very sensible thing to do in the Civil War.
Well, yes,
I mean,
don't forget, most people didn't have a direct say in how the city was run. So the city fathers, the merchant venturers, as it then was, they ran things, and most ordinary people didn't have much of a say. Although, of course, there were quite strong opinions on both sides. And at the beginning of the Civil War, I mean, Bristol, basically being a commercial place, didn't want any trouble. So basically the attitude was, if this would all go away, that would be very convenient for us. So they tried as long as they could not to take sides. Then they were forced to take sides, and ultimately the parliamentarians, because Bristol is part of the South West, which is one of the core areas for Parliament, the parliamentarians took over, and Nathaniel Fiennes became the military commander of the garrison. When the royalists turned up to try and take the city, Prince Rupert decided that they were going to just storm the city rather than besiege it. So they were just going to try and instead of setting up siege lines and taking their time, they were just going to try and charge in there and take it over. And they succeeded, but they only really succeeded because Fiennes basically was an incompetent who surrendered as soon as they broke through the first line of defence. And if there was no reason for him to do that, they could have decided to fight.
No, there was. There is a very good reason in a siege, and that is that you're thinking, well, we're playing the long game, rather like Marvin was doing.
Jeremy Corbyn and Keir Starmer. What you don't want is a fight.
What you do is you just, at the first sign of trouble, you give in, and then you play the long game. You say, well, actually, we're going to be pretending to be on your Hill's side.
Right, well,
but we
you,
might
you
not
asked
be.
Me for my opinion.
The idea is to not destroy the city, not, you know.
Well, if that would have been Fien's motivation, then he would.
The longer the siege goes on, the more the besiegers are going to cause.
Well, there was a massive siege in Gloucester that went on for months and months and months, and they could easily have done that, and that's what Parliament wanted him to do. But what he didn't do it, and of course he got the blame. Parliament were very unhappy
wasn't it,
with
it. Wouldn't it have been the city fathers, actually, maybe at the time, the merchant venturers, that told him what to do?
No, Fien's could and should, if from a parliamentary point of view, have put up a stouter defence.
But that's from a London point of view. It's almost like saying, stand and fight to the last man.
All right, well,
you actually have to deal with it.
All right, well, you're asking me my opinion about what happened in the siege of Bristol. Okay?
Well, I'm quizzing you about it, yeah.
Well, I'm saying...
I'm still interested in your opinion, Martin.
Yeah, the point is that Fien's was blamed by the parliament for giving the city up. Because it was a major thing. They managed to retain Gloucester, which turned out to be decisive. But if Fien's had put up a proper fight in Bristol, it would have been quite difficult to take the city. And of course, you know, Prince Rupert was taking a big risk by trying an over assault, and they lost a lot of people. Yeah, the royalists had basically given up. They'd lost loads and loads of people. They were about to retreat, and then Fien's decided that he was going to run off.
Well, he didn't know that.
That's what happens in battles. People don't know what's going on.
You can see from a capitalist merchant's point of view, they don't really want them to burn the city down. They'd much rather make a little deal, and then we'll see
There was no little deal, Tony. I'm just telling you the factual stuff about what happened. Fien's ran away. He got the blame. He was going to be court-martialed by the parliament, but he had very influential relatives, and he was basically protected.
He scooted out the country.
Yes, that's right. But then ultimately, of course, the royalists then held the city. They carried out reprisals against people that they didn't like, just as when the parliamentarians held the city, they allowed the royalists to get together and make a little plot, and then they were all making a little plot in a pub. They turned up and arrested them all, which is a classic sort of modern honey.
Intelligence work.
Yeah, intelligence work, that's right. But when the parliamentarians came back, they besieged the city, and then by that stage they're winning. They've got all the cannon they need. They could really destroy the city if they didn't surrender. And the royalists at that point, it was Prince Rupert decided it's probably not worth destroying the city, and he marched out. He was allowed to march out of the city with his troops. And he basically saved the city from being properly besieged.
Yeah, and he may have been under orders as well. But anyway,
Prince Rupert then fell out with Charles I. Charles I said to him, "You should have defended the city to the death."
Oh, yeah.
And Rupert said, what for? You know, we were going to lose anyway. It was time to withdraw.
I reminded a little bit about Singapore and the orders that came from Churchill to Gordon Bennett and the other officers holding Singapore when they were told, fight to the last man. And they said, well, hang on a minute, because we haven't got the ammunition we asked for. We haven't got the aircraft we asked for. We haven't got the water that we need to supply the troops. And that's why they surrendered, because they just knew there was really no point in fighting.
Well, that's why Prince Rupert surrendered, because he could have put up a bigger fight.
Yeah.
But by that stage of the war, all that would have happened, it would have been disastrous for the city of Bristol. And of course, by marching out with his troops, and they were allowed to take their weapons with them, they lived to fight another day.
Okay,
but of course, it was regarded by Charles I as a betrayal, and his personal relationship with Prince Rupert just
didn't
collapsed.
Didn't Prince
at that
Rupert
point.
Flee the country at that
well,
point?
Prince Rupert actually
this is
leave
all
the
these
country.
People well, of course, supposed
a lot of
to be sent.
A lot of royalists had to leave the country
it's not
at that
just
point.
Royalists, it's parliamentarians who were supposed to be defending Bristol, decided they had to get on a ship and leave immediately because
well,
they didn't
right.
bother to
but
do
I
it.
Mean, in other words,
interesting
two of the biggest battles of the Civil War were fought in the streets around this arts centre. Both the sieges of Bristol were decisive in terms of the direction of the battle for the whole country.
But nowhere near as many people were killed as in the big Edge Hill and places
yes, I know,
like
but don't forget those were battles in
pitch
the
battles
in the countryside with armed men.
But did Roundway Down, there was a big battle there, wasn't
there? Yes, there was lots of battles, but I mean, sieges are more, as we're seeing in Gaza now, much more problematic because the civilian population are in the middle of sieges. It's not like a battle between two lots of soldiers.
No. So let's go back to the. I mean, so we're going to have obviously the talk by Marvin Rees at the Beacon Centre. That will be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, the full version of that, but also the full version of this, because this is just a little excerpt. Do you know what happened to Bristol Castle and why that's no longer there?
Well, I mean, the general people's general knowledge about that is when the Parliament won, Bristol Castle was one of the strongest castles in the country.
It had never been attacked either, apparently. Never been attacked. No, but it was a fantastic castle.
I mean, if really strong castles, you don't bother to attack them. That's why you've got really strong castles.
You can besiege them, maybe.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you don't even bother if it's that strong, do you? No. It's a waste of time. So, all over the country, the parliamentarians slighted royalist castles like Corfe Castle in Dorset.
Yeah.
They blew up the walls.
Yeah, undermined them.
And in Wigmore Castle up in Herefordshire, the parliamentary family that owned it blew it up rather than allow it to fall into the hands of the royalists. So a lot of castles.
They were worried, wasn't he? Cromwell was worried that the royalists might regroup around the stronghold somewhere after the war.
These strongholds were the strongholds of the traditional aristocracy. So one of the things he did is he got rid of all these castles.
So did he do that in Bristol?
Well, in Bristol, I think it was got rid of because there was other commercial reasons that they wanted to get rid of the castle.
10 out of 10, my wonderful PPE student. You get a double A plus for that one. So let's have a listen to Richard Strides explaining what happened to Bristol Castle in the English Civil War.
Cromwell wanted to slight the castle, he wanted to damage it, but the Bristolians themselves were very keen to remove it, and they were asking, can we please get rid of it? Because it wasn't technically part of Bristol, because it was royal land. So it had always been legally a problem that it was right in the centre of Bristol, was on this prime land, was this bit of land that they didn't even own, that somebody else owned. It was under somebody else's jurisdiction. So Bristolians were very keen to demolish it, sell the stone, build stuff.
So that's what happened. Never a shot were fired at Bristol Castle. It was all just pulled down because it was a royalist owned piece of land.
In other words, the city fathers had always been resentful of having a royalist castle in the middle of their town, and this was an opportunity to get rid of it, so they got rid of it. And of course, the parliamentarians generally were quite in favour of getting rid of these castles if there were going to be a problem, because what they feared, as you exactly say, is that the royalist aristocracy are going to come back and they're going to they're going to make trouble from these castles.
So that talk by Richard Stride will be up on our show page tonight at thisweek.org.uk. Also this week in Bristol here, we've had an occupation of the HQ of Elbit. Now, do you know much about Elbit, Martin?
Well, only what I've been hearing from on the feeds I'm getting from Bristol Palestine Campaign. I mean, it's
an Israeli firm.
It operates here in Bristol.
The HQ is in Bristol, so they've got various plants around the country, but the offices are it's all run from here.
Well, if you think about it, North Bristol, Aztec West. That sort of area, Bradley Stoke, is basically an arms manufactory. That's what it is. And Bristol's current prosperity, such as it is based on arms production.
Well, they talk about high tech, don't they?
We always hear
government saying, oh, we're going to have all this high tech. Well, actually, what they really mean is high tech killing machines.
Yes, well, I mean, if you remember Jerry Hicks, who used to be the chief shop steward up at Rolls Royce, he worked there since he left school at 16. And then in the noughties, he came back from holiday to find that he'd been sacked by Rolls Royce because they were going to invest a load more money in Rolls Royce and in BAE Systems. BAE Systems have just won the contract to build these nuclear submarines for the Australians to threaten the Chinese. And they got rid of him, because they didn't want somebody of his politics to be, chief shop steward at Rolls-Royce. And he did eventually get compensation, as David Miller hopefully will, from Bristol University, but he couldn't get his job back because they forced him out. And that's because, Bristol is a major arms manufacturing city. And ultimately, of course, that's got implications for all sorts of things, hasn't it?
The interesting thing about Elbit is that they are really at the cutting edge of this whole thing of the drone wars. So anyway, yesterday, I think it was late last night, the bailiffs turned up and it was evicted. But there was, for a couple of days, this little group occupying the land outside Elbit's factory up at Aztec West. And I spoke to Dav, who's one of the people occupying it.
They make a product called a Hermes drone, which you can look up. I don't know its exact dimensions, but I know it's not a little toy drone, and it definitely carries killing munitions. So, yeah, we're not talking about toy drones here. We're talking about very serious big bits and a lot of money's worth of kit. So yeah, I mean, it's one of those things you have to kind of really dig deep to find it, because they don't publicise a lot of it, because they don't want us to know exactly what's going on. But part of the reason I think they're in this country is because they're in bed with lots of other companies, some of them UK companies like Thales, Kinetech, Raytheon, Boeing, BAE Systems. You know, they all make small components for all of these things, which are then put together somewhere and then taken out there. So I think that's part of the reason why they have to have a manufacturing base here, and it's why it's really important we shut them down.
Yeah. Airbus as well, actually, is another company that they're involved in. They're, of course, just over the road, aren't they, in Filton. We have this weird dilemma now going on where nobody's actually involved, and sometimes the operators of the drones aren't even involved, and it's all left to a computer to do it. So this, to me, seems like it's almost like the Terminator world that we're moving into.
Yeah, it's totally dystopian, and when you've got AI choosing the targets, there's almost no accountability. So you really have to wonder what goes through the minds of people that are happy to let AI loose on a civilian population. But ultimately, it comes down to the fact that, as you say, it's an ethical decision whether I want to spend my time going to work in a system in a country like England, which is actively supporting a genocide, or whether I'd rather take some time off work, lose some money, lose some pay, and probably catch a cold, and just sit here and do what I can just to highlight the absolute staggering hypocrisy of the West at the moment.
So that's Dab speaking to me yesterday. Full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later this evening. The people there are very much aware of this idea of letting AI loose on a civilian population to kill them.
Yes, and there's going to be another protest, not a camp, but a protest tomorrow outside Elbit's headquarters in Bolingbroke Way, I think it is, just off Bolingbroke Way. People can look it up on the internet. That's at 1 o'clock tomorrow, because there isn't a national demonstration in London this week. What's being exposed with this genocide in Gaza is the complicity of the West in what's going on there, and the linkages lead straight back to our own fair city here in Bristol, which is a major arms manufacturer, and was, you know, ultimately, you know, people's prosperity in this city has depended to some extent on killing other people's children. And that's not really put too fine a point on it. That's exactly what it is.
I also this week spoke to Chris Cole from Drone Wars UK. It's a campaigning group against drones, and I started chatting to him. It's probably about a 40-minute interview altogether, which will be up on our show page later tonight at thisweek.org.uk. But as I was trying to chat to him about the use of drones in places like Gaza, here in the UK maybe as well, we've got US drones now being launched from RAF Fairford, beginning to be launched from there. No one really knows where they're going for thousands of miles and maybe coming back, maybe not. But Britain is now a launching pad for these US drones. He very quickly steered the subject onto this whole idea of autonomous drones, the idea that no human being will get involved in what they do, and also that you can send the drones out. And one of the problems is, Martin, that if you're interrupt, they can be hacked, these things. So the best thing to do is just to allow them to program them to just make decisions all on their own without having to have someone trying to get through to them by some sort of communication. So they just decide for themselves.
Well, yes, and we can see what the drone warfare in the East Ukraine is the most advanced drone warfare that we've seen anywhere on the planet. And of course, everybody is watching this. All the different militaries are watching it very, very closely. And they're trying to work out what the implications are for tactics and strategy. And the same thing, of course, is true of Ansar Allah in Yemen. They are very, very good at drones. It's their own technology, as explained to us by Dr. Judith Brown the other week. And what it's doing is the drone is becoming like the longbow was on the medieval battlefield. The tank is actually vulnerable to the drone. A $2,000 drone can knock out millions of dollars of tank. And this is changing things quite dramatically. And of course, in Ukraine, it's leading to more World War One style fighting rather than World War Two style fighting.
That's a whole new industry that has grown up over the last decade. You know, there is this cycle, isn't there, of kind of military companies developing a new weapon system, and then at the same time, they also develop a counter weapon system. There are a number of different technologies, mainly at the moment focusing around jamming the communications between the operator and the drone itself. But some of the drones that fly, the kind of real issue that we are seeing now is autonomy coming more and more into drone warfare. And drones really are the gateway to autonomous weapon systems. So there are kind of two issues about this, two ways in which autonomy is coming in. One is in relation to the data infrastructure that I talked about, where autonomy is being introduced to analyze huge amounts of data that are being captured by drones and captured in all sorts of ways. So, for instance, at the moment, we're seeing in Gaza, Israel using a system called Hasbora, which is an AI system that trawls through various data sets that they've captured over the last however many years, and using that to produce targets in Gaza. And we've seen real upswing. The IDF are very proud of this and proud of talking about how normally they would, intelligence, they would produce around 50 targets a week. They're now producing 100 targets a day. We know it's long been recognized and acknowledged that the kind of, you know, structures of injustice in our society are embedded in our data, in our data sets. So, for instance, in, Israel in Gaza, where Israel captures all sorts of data about Palestinians, and that's fed into a data set, and the kind of assumptions and misinformation and prejudices against Palestinians are enshrined in that data set. And that data set is then trawled by AIs to come up with targets. And the problem, of course, is that it's not possible for humans to oversee this work. So there's a real concern about how AI is coming into and being used to analyze data.
I mean, does it not, when it comes up with the target, that system say, well, this person is a target because, I don't know, maybe, for example, they spoke to a member of Hamas, or they voted for Hamas, or this sort of thing? Does it not say, well, this person is a target because? It just says, well, we recommend you kill this person. Is that how it works, this Hasbara thing?
Well, we just don't know, because there is not enough transparency about how it actually works. All we know about it is what these IDF say about it, and that's heavily censored and heavily controlled. But yes, it will be capturing, you know, relationships data. So if somebody lives in the same neighborhood or has met somebody, you know, all that kind of information is kept and fed into these data sets.
And maybe databases. Say they've messaged them on their phone, all this sort of thing. So this is a completely autonomous system of saying, basically, kill this person, kill that person. But then what about the other end when it actually comes to doing the job?
Well, there is a real push now towards to develop autonomous drones. And, you know, in some ways that may be not so troubling. So, for instance, there is kind of like the autonomy of the movement of the system. It's more like an automatic pilot. But what is of a real concern is allowing systems themselves to decide which target and how to kill and to launch the use of force. At the moment, I think there is general acknowledgement that that would be unlawful, because machines cannot differentiate between civilians and combatants, for example, cannot work out the ability of whether it's a legitimate military target or what the advantage is of undertaking the strike. So that's all far too complicated for machines. But the problem is there is a real push to allow machines to do this and to develop the technology to allow machines to do this. because one of the weak links for drones is the electronic communications, and that's becoming jammed. So the military and military thinkers and strategists are arguing that we need to kind of free the drones, if you like, and allow them to undertake these processes, allow them to be much more autonomous and make the decisions themselves. So there is a real pushback around the world against this, but unfortunately, you know, military strategists hold a lot of power and a lot of sway over politicians, and are persuading them that, you know, as you say, they will argue that China is doing this or Russia is doing it, so we need to keep up with them. The reality is that it's Western firms that are very much pushing the development of autonomous weapon systems.
Yeah,
well, and the government have said recently that, you know, an international treaty banning autonomous weapon systems is a threat to national security. And so that's the kind of, you know, what we're facing at the moment.
Yeah, so autonomous weapon systems, the government, our people we pay are saying, oh, we don't want to have any kind of treaty banning this because that is a threat to national security. They're not interested in the ethics of it. In fact, they are now encouraging this whole concept of the Terminators.
Yes, I'd just like to comment about what's actually happening in Gaza. I think a lot of this stuff about we're able to generate 100 targets a day as opposed to whatever they were doing before, that's really just PR, because they don't really care who they're targeting. Don't forget, they've bombed the place to pieces. People aren't in where they used to live, for example, so you don't know where they are. I imagine Hamas fighters are not using mobile phones. They'd be fools if they did. Obviously, what's happened in the Ukraine, anybody with a mobile phone, they can be whacked immediately from the air. So that, you know, therefore, you know, Russian soldiers are not allowed to take their mobile phones with them on their tour of duty. They just don't communicate with their families at all during that period. I think that the drones are here to stay, and it's the big drones, you know, the ones that are being developed by Elbit Systems or whatever, they are also being shot down by Ansar Allah with their own homemade drones. And of course, if the homemade drone costs $2,000 and the expensive one is like, you know, $2 or $3 million, then you know, they're going to run out of them. And that's the issue.
I think one of the other things that is really important to remind ourselves and listeners of is the fact that much of this military aid that's going to places like Ukraine and Gaza, or to Israel, is just bouncing straight back to Elbit Systems and people like that here in the West.
Well,
a lot of it's being laundered, apparently.
Yes, I know, but who was saying this the other day? Was it Victoria Nuland or somebody else was saying, and we should fund this stuff because in actual fact, this is creating jobs at home here in, you know, all this money we're giving to the Ukraine, it actually gets spent in America. And of course it does. And of course the stuff they then supply to the Ukraine then gets sold onto the black market or never gets used or whatever. It's just a great big boondoggle.
Yeah, well, there's one person now in the Houses of Parliament, his name is George Galloway, who has the guts to stand up to people who are calling for support for the Israelis, and that's because he's just in his own little party called the Workers' Party, and he's not in the Labour Party anymore. And it'd be nice to see more Labour MPs just coming over to George Galloway and saying, look, actually, I think the future is with you, because that's where my conscience lies. But unfortunately, the House of Commons and the parliamentary parties there seem to have become just, over the years, I don't know how this has happened, just bit by bit, I suppose it's Thatcherism, isn't it? They've become almost like a kind of revolving door conveyor belt for people's careers, Martin, after they leave Parliament. And many, many MPs feel, oh, I've done my time now, I'm going to go into big business.
Well, that's certainly true on the Tory benches, and certainly some of the Labour members would be included in that. But, you know, you've still got Jeremy Corbyn sitting as an independent for Islington. You've still got Diane Abbott sitting as an independent for Hackney.
Why won't they join George Galloway in the Workers' Party?
Because if you do that, you then create a situation where the trade unions who fund the Labour Party are... what we want to do, if we split the Labour Party, is we want to take the trade union money.
That's a key thing. And that's why, as a trade unionist, you've got to be very careful. You don't just vote to go on strike and go on strike at every opportunity.
Won't the trade unions then decide to switch their money to Jeremy Corbyn's party?
Until they have, you've got to be very cautious. And, of course, we don't have a PR
system. These people are supposed to be leaders, not followers.
No, but it's also, don't forget, it's like you were talking earlier about not defending cities if you're going to have everything destroyed, yeah? Don't forget that if we set up an alternative to the Labour Party which crashes and burns, then that's our go at doing that. Yeah. And we've only got to have one go, so we've got to get it right.
And that's why. It's not because Jeremy Corbyn's got personal differences with George Galloway.
Well, I mean, there may be personal differences as well. George Galloway is a very admirable figure in many ways, but one thing I would say about him, he's not got a reputation as a team player, okay? Unlike Ken Livingstone.
Well, why is it that he offered... he was making, you know, great offers for, you know, Jeremy Corbyn may be able to lead this Workers' Party if he wants to join
it. Well, that's a matter for Jeremy Corbyn, and I'm not going to second guess what he's decided to do.
I think he is a team player. That's one of the things that indicates, doesn't it?
No.
If he is happy for Corbyn to lead the party he started, that does indicate that he may be a team player.
Well, at some point, Jeremy Corbyn may or may not make the decision to try and, at the moment, his position is, I want to be back in the Labour Party. And that was the position of Ken Livingstone when he was kicked out of the Labour Party. And he kicked his way back in.
Some hope. That happened in the old days. I don't think that's going to happen now.
See what happens.
He's hanging on with his fingers crossed. Don't hold your breath, Jeremy Corbyn. Anyway, let's have a listen to George Galloway now, speaking in the House of Commons.
I don't demur at all from the idea that Lord Cameron is a skilled international diplomat. Our problem is, as a country, who are forever lecturing other people on the quality of their democracy, now have an unelected head of state, an unelected prime minister, and an unelected foreign secretary, the second most important piece on the treasury bench. And that's ruritarian. It's actually rather absurd if you start to consider it. As the Honourable Gentleman for Glasgow North was adumbrating the possible outcomes of a lectern being erected just at that white line there, so that we could all, and the microphones would need to be adjusted, face that way instead of, Madam Deputy Speaker, facing towards you. That's ridiculous. If there was a will, there would be a way. The silence from the government in response to the procedure committees beseeching of them to find a solution to this is eloquent, as such lengthy silences always are. We have a situation where daily, if not hourly, new and dramatic foreign policy developments are occurring. Just this day, for example, Prime Minister Netanyahu announced that this port that's being built in Gaza, with the rubble of the homes destroyed in the bombing, including the skulls and the bones of the people destroyed with the houses and lying unburied under the rubble, that according to Netanyahu, this port is being built for the deportation of millions of Palestinians from the territory. An act of ethnic cleansing of the foulest kind. We would have expected a statement from the Foreign Secretary in the light of such a dramatic development. But statement came there none, and could come there none. His able deputy, and I share the Honourable Gentleman's feelings for the Minister of State, a fine man, I've known him a very long time, he cannot possibly cope with all of this workload as effectively Lord Cameron's deputy in here, his vicar on earth in here. But even if he could, he still would not be the Foreign Secretary. We cannot continue to be a democratic country.
So that's George Galloway MP for Rochdale, Workers' Party's only representative in the House of Commons. So he's really, what he's saying there is, you've got an unelected Foreign Secretary, you've also got an unelected Prime Minister. And there's no accountability for all this stuff that's going on in Gaza. Cameron is way away from it all. In fact, he was appointed, wasn't he, after this all started. I think it was about 2 weeks, or maybe 3 weeks, maybe 4 weeks after it. It was at the time of the Remembrance Day service when Cameron and Sunak and King Charles all walked into the Foreign Office together, and the next day it was announced that Cameron's going to be the new Foreign Secretary.
Well, the British state is a feudal anachronism. That is undoubtedly the case. And the sort of people who end up in Parliament, particularly on the Tory benches, they actually quite like the feudalism of it all.
Why does it matter that he's a Lord, Cameron, rather than an MP?
Well, if he's not a Lord, he can't be the Foreign Secretary, because he's not got any basis in politics, has he? You can't appoint a foreign secretary has to be a parliamentarian, because he's not elected to Parliament, that is to say to the House of Commons. If he's made a Lord, he can be the Foreign Secretary.
So they could actually just decide, we're going to make Martin Summers a Lord today, yes, and you're going to be Foreign Secretary.
That's right. And of course, it has happened in the past. I believe there is Tory Foreign Secretaries in the past. Alec Douglas Hume, I think, I can't remember. He was a Lord, but he was also Foreign Secretary.
So that's the home front. Anyway, I think brilliant points made by George Galloway, not being made really by anybody else. But what about the other side? What about over in Israel itself? Well, there's a brilliant magazine called Plus 972 Magazine, who've done some brilliant exposés, particularly of the far right amongst the rabbis in Israel. Here is one of their journalists speaking a couple of weeks ago about the sort of censorship that's going on for them now. I mean, they are almost like us, but they're actually a much bigger organization. They're a sort of do you know much about Plus 972, Martin?
I have heard the name, and I am aware that they are looking into things of the nature you've described.
But, it must be very difficult, actually, if you're a peace loving journalist actually operating in Israel right now.
Well, it must be horrendous, but in actual fact, it is interesting that Haaretz, who is the Israeli version of The Guardian, have been much more robust in their criticism of Israeli policy than The Guardian here. So there you go.
Well, Plus 972 Magazine, just to give you an idea, that's what they call themselves. A few of their headlines today, Martin, he says, the spiralling absurdity of Germany's pro-Israel fanaticism. What they're actually saying is, as repression of Palestinian solidarity penetrates every sector of life, the state's liberal self-image is fast becoming a story Germany can only tell themselves. So, well, what's happening with Germany then on
this? Well, Germany, at the end of World War II, the post-war regime in West Germany and then now in United Germany, has always taken a super, super pro-Israeli position, because it's out of guilt. You know, we murdered 6 million Jews, and therefore we've got to support the State of Israel, whatever they do. Whereas I would argue that in actual fact, the Germans are responsible for killing the Jews, and by helping the Israelis, they're also now responsible for killing the Palestinians. Now, who's really to blame here? Oh, it's the Germans. It's you. You're to blame. You were to blame for the original massacres of the Jews, and you're also to blame for your uncritical support for Israel. And of course, they are leaning very heavily on pro-Palestine demonstrators and so on. It's an absurdity, but there it is.
Good old Plus 972. I suggest everybody bookmark it if you can manage to do that. You know, sometimes it's a bit complicated to figure out how to do bookmarks, but anyway, bookmark it on your browser. For example, they're looking at what's going on in London. They said a no-go zone for Jews? The making of a moral panic in London. So they're looking at the sort of propaganda efforts over here in the UK, trying to support the Israeli state. They say politicians and the media are deliberately inflating, sensationalising a narrative for a repressive agenda. So they're looking at both at things going on in Gaza and in Israel and in the UK here. So fantastic magazine. Anyway, I'm sorry I don't know the guy's name, but here's one of their journalists explaining what they're having to do over at 972, Plus 972 in Israel.
The Israeli government is moving to restrict journalists in all sorts of ways. which is true and dangerous. One very important factor has been the refusal to allow foreign journalists into Gaza. I think a main motivation there is to, there are two motivations actually, I think. One is to prevent reporting that can be seen by people who have bias against Palestinian journalists as more reliable. It's easier for Israel to keep saying that all Palestinian journalists are terrorists. You know, the kind of rhetoric we've been hearing from Israeli leaders and journalists, and just discount any report coming out of Gaza because it's all by Palestinian journalists. Whereas if you allow foreign crews into Gaza, it'll be much harder for Israel to deny just the scale of the devastation, the death, the starvation that's going on there. I think the second motivation that's been outspoken has been that Israel cannot commit to their safety of those foreign journalists. So basically saying, if you go in, you might die from our attacks, and then you'll blame us. That's been a recurring line by Israel regarding this issue. I think this is deeply troubling. The Foreign Press Association here in Israel petitioned the Supreme Court demanding to be allowed entry into Gaza, and the Supreme Court sided with the government and the army by preventing foreign journalists from going into Gaza. So we're seeing that. We're seeing new bills trying to restrict the freedom of journalism. We're seeing new policies trying to restrict the freedom of journalism. And that in addition to what I think not many people remember is that Israel, while it calls itself a democracy, is the only such country that has a military censor where all of us, all Israeli journalists, are obliged to submit stories to the military censor before publication. And over 100 stories a year are just deleted and prevented from publication by the censor. And somewhere between 1,000 or 2,000 stories are redacted in different ways by the censor. And we're now seeing attempts to make that censorship process even worse, even more restrictive against journalists. But having said all of that, I want to say something that is completely different. We're talking about attacks on journalists and limitations on journalists. I think what we've been seeing in terms of Israeli journalism during this war is, and this has always been the problem with Israeli journalism, is that the worst censorship is the self-censorship. The censor and the laws and everything we're facing do not prevent Israeli journalists from giving a platform to people in Gaza to tell their stories, from showing the pictures and the stories of people in Gaza and what they're experiencing, from offering the wider context of the siege and the history of apartheid that has led up to October 7th, not making it justifiable in any way, but allowing us to be more informed and to think in different ways about how to deal with the challenge that October 7th presented. None of that is happening in Israeli media. And that is a choice of Israeli journalists. And this is where we in Local Call, working in Hebrew, but also 972 in English, are really trying to challenge Israeli media, kind of hold the media to account as well, and not just power, because it is playing such a central role in enabling this reality to go on. And it's both in terms of the facts that are not being shared with the Israeli public, but also the interpretation. So the fact that for 4.5 months now, we have not seen people who criticize the war allowed on TV. Basically, you have not that there, that there are not many of us, but the people who go out protesting, who demonstrate, are being beaten by police, don't get to explain why they oppose the war. The members of Knesset that oppose the war don't get an opportunity to explain what alternatives they see to the war, what's wrong with the war. Those opinions are just not being heard. When there's reporting about demonstrations abroad in D.C. or in London or wherever, they're just portrayed as anti-Semitic. When there's talk about how the international media is depicting the reality in Gaza, it's perceived as anti-Semitic instead of actually listening to what is being told.
Well, I just think it's just fascinating to get an insight from one of the, shall we say, radical, alternative, independent, freelance magazines over in Israel that's reporting the news, particularly from both sides of that conflict, but also looking at the what you might call for us the home front in the United States and Britain, Martin.
Yeah, I mean, it's great that people like him are still, you know, fighting the good fight there in Israel.
The censor's amazing, isn't it? It's not a democracy if you've got a censor like this that's pulling in stories. That they're saying, he was saying there that 100-plus stories a year are just spiked completely. The public are not allowed to read them. The military have got rid of them totally. Obviously, it would be an interesting book if anyone can get hold of those 100 stories that the Israeli military have censored, and you could publish them as a book. That would be a rather wonderful thing to read. I'm not sure which intelligence service might be able to have access to those. But anyway, please publish them as a book, somebody. But then 1,000 also have been redacted. So important key facts just blanked out of stories by the military. It's not a democracy at all.
Well, it is a democracy, but the information flow of the people in the democracy
that's not a democracy then.
Well, what is a democracy?
A democracy means if the people rule, the people have to know what's going on, and the journalists have to be able to tell the people.
Yeah.
And if they can't tell the people, the military's saying, no, you can't tell them that.
Yeah,
you can't
don't
tell them
forget,
that. That's not a democracy.
Well, many Palestinians living in refugee camps in Jordan, Syria, and
we're not talking
Lebanon.
About Jordan, Syria.
Yeah, but they should have a vote in the so-called democracy in Israel, but they don't have a vote.
What I'm saying in Israel is the vote is only means something if the people are informed, and if the military is censoring information going to the people, you don't have an informed population, and you don't have a democracy.
Well, you don't have a democracy in Israel for another reason, as I've just pointed out. A large proportion of the population that used to live there has simply been booted out, and they don't get a vote. They're stateless. They haven't got a passport even. They can't leave the camps which their families were thrown into in the 1940s. And the same is true, of course, of the people in Gaza.
Anyway, Plus 972 magazine, great, great stuff. Definitely stick it on your bookmarks, folks, before they get nobbled in whatever way they may get nobbled. We shall see. Bless them. Fantastic lot. Anyway, there's staying with the subject of Gaza, there's been some documentaries come out this week, particularly interesting ones. One from Al Jazeera, just simply calling itself October the 7th.
All the footage I've seen of the Hamas assault across the border, across the fence into the kibbutzes, they're pretty much only armed with light weapons. This is RPGs, so rocket-propelled grenades and personal sidearms. This is taken from the inside of a house. Two holes in the wall here. I would say probably by some sort of heavy weapon fired against the house, most probably a tank. There's no way an RPG and a would make that sort of damage. In this image here, catastrophic structural damage to the building, clearly not caused by a structural collapse from a fire. This was caused by some sort of heavy weapon system during combat. There's catastrophic structural damage to many of these buildings. This can only have happened by heavy weapon systems being used against the kibbutz itself.
The I unit calculates that 1,154 Israelis and foreign nationals are killed on October 7 and in the days immediately afterwards. Of these, 256 are soldiers. 53 belong to the police and other security forces. And 63 are civilian security guards. The remaining 782 victims are unarmed. The I unit's list of the dead reveals that at least 18 are killed by Israeli ground troops. A number of other bodies are recovered from beneath rubble who died in circumstances that are unclear. In the days following October 7, journalists are shown around the kibbutzim by the Israeli army.
This is something that monsters do, not humans.
Hamas fighters and others committed crimes on October 7. The Israeli media, however, focuses not on the crimes they committed, but on crimes they did not.
I'm talking to some of the soldiers, and they say what they've witnessed as they've been walking through these different houses, these different communities, babies, their heads cut off. That's what they said. No one could expect that it would be like this, the horrors that I'm hearing from these soldiers. As I mentioned earlier, about 40 babies, at least, were taken out on gurneys.
The I-Unit's list of the dead shows no babies were killed in Kfar Aza, the kibbutz this report came from. The story was nevertheless picked up by international media and repeated by President Biden.
I've been doing this a long time. I never really thought that I would see and have confirmed pictures of terrorists beheading children.
The White House later clarifies that actually, the president had not seen pictures of beheaded children. A senior Israeli military officer later speaks to journalists in front of a burnt-out house in Kibbutz Be'eri. It's the house where 12 hostages appear to have been killed during the assault by the Israeli police and army.
Inside this house were another 15 burned people, among them 8 babies in this corner. They were concentrated them, and they killed them, and they burned them.
Well, did you see?
I evacuated.
The list of the dead shows that there were no babies in the house. And Colonel Vach does not tell journalists that the casualties are almost certainly caused by Israeli forces.
So that's the sort of documentary World in Action and BBC Panorama used to do back in the day, Martin. Actually, Al Jazeera have done, I think it's a 50-minute documentary all about the evidence that the Israelis have exaggerated massively the actions of Hamas on the 7th of October last year.
Yeah, well, Peter Oborne makes the point you've just made in an article that it's on Middle East Eye. And he says that back in the day, the BBC or ITV or CNN or whoever would have investigated all this, and they'd have produced a documentary showing that it was just a load of war propaganda. But of course, it's left to Al Jazeera to do this in English language. And of course, Al Jazeera hasn't been banned in Britain yet. Yeah. And it's them that has to do it because neither it's a job that BBC should have done.
We haven't been banned yet. But I think the idea seems to be to keep both sides, the extreme sides, going. So the idea is you're hardening the sides. You're informing your anti-Israel and your pro-Israel. This is what Chris Mulligan used to, remember interviewing him years ago, saying that's what they do. They harden the sides. They make sure that you've got a massive camp of millions of people or billions of people on one side and another massive camp on the other side. So you boost those two points of view by having TV and mass media pushing those points of view. So you've got to have something like Al Jazeera in order to do that. It's interesting that they've got rid of the Russians. But there's also, I mean, that was looking, wasn't it, at the, particularly at Kibbutz Be'eri and some other kibbutzes, the way that they were absolutely smashed to pieces by actually either mortar or tank rounds. Now, those were not fired by Hamas.
No, they couldn't possibly have been. And Peter Oborne points out that this is a high-quality documentary. It's not saying, as the quote we just heard, they're not saying that Hamas didn't carry out heinous acts on the day, because they did. But they just didn't do what the Israelis said. I mean, if you think about it, when we had the front of the Daily Mail screaming 40 beheaded babies, how can you imagine that Hamas fighters in the middle of a fight with the Israeli army have got time to round up 40 babies and behead them? I mean, it's an obvious made up thing. Yeah. And of course, similar propaganda was used in the First World War about the Germans bayoneting babies. And we remember the incubators that switched off in Kuwait by Saddam Hussein's evil troops. We remember the Bucha massacre carried out by the evil Russian soldiers after they'd captured Bucha, except it looks now, with hindsight, that was carried out by the Ukrainians. And of course, this stuff has consequences, because if people are told some lurid story like that and they don't get any, you know, counter information, then it means that they're kind of, at least at the minimum, they're complacent about what the Israelis then do to their so-called enemies.
Well, look, that's not the only documentary that's come out on October the 7th this week. There's also another one called October the 7th was an inside job. Martin, that looks at the Supernova Festival particularly, and lots of things to do with that. So, for example, there are photographs of a whole load of cars that had obviously been destroyed and shot up either by, probably by helicopters,
Hellfire missiles. We're not really sure.
And they had been removed and dumped in a particular area, and a whole load of completely untouched cars had been put there in their place. So it's an amazing photograph in this documentary I was watching, which shows that all around these untouched cars, there's burnt and scorched earth. So it was. It looks pretty obvious that the Israeli intelligence or somebody has come along, removed all these burnt-out cars and put a lot of non-burnt-out cars in their place to look as if nobody was actually destroying those cars. So anyway, let's have a little listen now, an excerpt from this other documentary about October the 7th called October 7 Was an Inside Job.
It's beyond our capacity to imagine such evil.
Now let's remind ourselves that lawyers representing 42 survivors of the music festival are suing the military for failing to notify the concert organizers that the night before there were signs of a possible Hamas attack. The lawyers learned that the top security officials held two emergency meetings at 3 a.m. on Saturday, 3 hours before the rockets announced the beginning of the Hamas attack, the Mossad operation. The lawyers wrote that this failure was incomprehensible. Well, they hadn't seen this video, which I think makes this failure completely comprehensible.
It's beyond our capacity to imagine such evil.
Not anymore, it's not. Sadly, there are still more opportunities for us to learn to comprehend such evil. You see, with all these reports of an insane increase in Hamas activity near the border, only 2 days before the festival was planned to start, the location was moved right up to the border. And, it seems, all the local military people in the Gaza division opposed holding so large a festival so close to the Gaza border. It was just unnecessarily dangerous, and they were overruled by the higher-ups, who were the guys receiving the reports from the spotters of all the increased Hamas activities. We've seen all this evidence showing that Hamas doesn't kill civilians, and that the IDF does kill its own, firing tank shells into houses full of hostages, deliberately leaving their women spotters like lambs to the slaughter. And as the weeks passed, insanely incriminating stories continued to come out, especially in the Hebrew language press, about the slaughter of festival goers by the Israeli helicopters. The command to attack and slaughter civilians came from the military's high command. In an interview with Israel's Mako news outlet, one Apache pilot reflected that he knew that many of these vehicles may have contained Israeli captives, but he chose to open fire anyway. The Apache pilots testified that they fired a huge amount of munitions, emptied the belly of the helicopters in minutes, flew to rearm and return to the air again and again. The Apache helicopters appear to have focused on vehicles from the Nova Electronic Music Festival and attacked cars with apparent knowledge that Israeli captives could be inside. They also fired on unarmed people exiting cars or walking on foot through the fields. You read it, now see it.
So that's the documentary there is called October the 7th Was an Inside Job. Some really damning photographs, particularly I'd not seen any of this before, Martin. You maybe had done with your scrying eye on the internet. But this concept that there is actually a very clever operation to make it look as if the helicopter gunships that had gone backwards and forwards reloading, basically destroying everything around this supernova festival, never mind if only Hamas people were there, that to make it look as if they hadn't actually attacked the cars as people were trying to leave, etc., in panicking. Of course, that's what you're going to do, try and hop in your car and get out of the area. Those cars, it looks like, were destroyed by the Israeli helicopters.
Yes, and I think it's increasingly clear, and to my mind anyway, that this is all a deliberate ploy by the Israelis so that they could carry out the genocide which they are now engaged in. So I think in Israel itself, these issues are being aired, even though there's a very pro-war sentiment inside the Israeli population. They are actually asking these questions in a way that we're not. I mean, that guy who was the Labour candidate for Rochdale, in a private meeting, made a suggestion that it looks as if they'd let it happen so that they could carry out a genocide, immediately accused of anti-Semitism, and then thrown into the dustbin of history. Of course, George Galloway then capitalised on that. But it's become, I mean, and when they talk about anti-Semitism, there's been a very good Grey Zone article about this in the US. These various pro-Israeli organizations have been going on about how there's been a big increase in anti-Semitism, but they're including all protests against Israeli policy as anti-Semitic protests. I mean, this is absurd. We are being very, very heavily psychological warfare operated on, aren't we?
We certainly are. And we've had to talk about psychological operation. I don't know what you make of all this scandal over the last week or so with the photograph of Kate Middleton. I mean, it seems to me a bit absurd to think that she would be doing the photoshopping. No, this is going to be the PR people who has to be mentioned. The PR strategy for the royal family was written by a certain Jimmy Savile. Possibly has been revised since then, but that was revealed in a documentary last year, and actually the documents themselves written by Savile, penned by Savile, so you do wonder what's going on in the establishment here when Camilla Parker Bowles' brother Mark Shand dies in New York after a rather nasty head injury. This is from 2014. This is very old. But the brother of Prince Charles' wife, Camilla, Duchess of Cornwall, was in New York for Sotheby's Fabergé egg final auction. The event was raising money for the Elephant Family, an organisation he co-founded to help save the endangered Asian elephant. There was a report that the CBS News did. So in an after party, he's basically attacked. He went to smoke outside, apparently, and he fell backwards as he tried to re-enter through a revolving door, police told the Associated Press. So violent death of Camilla's brother. So these sorts of things do happen, don't they? We've also seen the death of somebody who was quite close to Prince William as well recently. So you do have to ask questions, I think, about these, whether there is a sort of elite mindset going on, a kind of cult mindset at the very top in the British establishment. And anybody that starts to say, well, hang on, we shouldn't be behaving like this, they end up dead.
Well, I'm not necessarily going to disagree with that, but it's a bit of a leap from discussing the war-related topic.
I don't think so at all, because that's possibly why these people are bumped off, like Robin Cook, because they're objecting to this way of doing things.
We've had this debate the previous weeks on this show. People are indeed assassinated all the time, but they're assassinated for different reasons by different people, and they're not necessarily all connected in one game. There may be some relationship between the Nova Festival and the massacre there and what's happened to the royal family, but it's pretty tenuous.
Okay, but before the break, another documentary out this week. It's called Climate, the Movie. Just before we hear from that, let's have a listen to Corey Morningstar. She's an environmental campaigner in the United States who is extremely worried, like Whitney Webb is, that there is a big attempt here to privatize the whole of nature.
In October, they want to pass it's called New Deal for Nature. It's a deal for capitalists, a deal for Wall Street. They want to monetize nature, global in scale. So everything will be, basically, they say what you can't measure, you can't manage. So everything will be monetized, traded. Their own scientists say things like those with money will own nature. John Elkington, I believe his name is, from Volans. He says, who will be the Bill Gates of ecosystem services? You know, what's that telling you? Who will be the Bill Gates of ecosystem services? Who will own the skies? Who will, is the commodification of nature, the monetization to be traded, bought, sold, enslavement of nature? And everyone's on board of as, like I said, Avaaz is behind it, Greenpeace is Avaaz behind it, World Wildlife Fund, they're all part and parcel. Friends of the Earth, you can't find it. Club of Rome, right? Club of Rome is a big one, which was one of the initial people they work with, We Don't Have Time, who was the person that put Greta out on social media, the very first tweet, Ingmar Rentzhog. So, you know, you can see everything's all interwoven, all the groups all interwoven together. This person's here. Anyway, back to the New Deal for Nature, probably the very, very best person to read a lot of what's behind it is Clive Spash. He's an ecologist, economist, and he's been brilliant on it. Probably one of the only people that haven't, you know, sold out going along. Yeah, so it's all these things coming forward. Digitalization of healthcare, telehealth, mHealth, digitalization of healthcare, automation of jobs. We just saw job loss is huge. Half the people in the world will lose their jobs. Okay, so that is the new oil. All life, your life, my life, we've become human capital, data commodities. Nature will be a portfolio of natural capital, all on the blockchain ledger. Everything's becoming like this is capitalism is next. Okay, so the capitalists basically figured out how to have so for centuries, capitalists, ruling classes stole the labor, right, from the working class. They stole the labor. They all became billionaires. Everything's stealing the labor. Everyone knows this, of the working classes. But now they found a way to replace the humans, right? So now, basically, they will make money off our data, and they will have us conform to the system. Like, we'll become completely compliant, for instance. And I have to say right now, the work of Alison McDowell to understand the blockchain and the smart contracts and how that will demand compliance to the system, even how New Deal for Nature, how nature will be all put into the blockchain. Alison McDowell is an independent researcher, a lot like myself. She just got into it. I forget how, I think through teaching. Anyway, she does a superb job of laying all this out. Also, Wrong Kind of Green has a primer on what blockchain is, what AI is, artificial intelligence, blockchain, how we, every time we use data, how it's becoming more and more clever. Anyway, all about that. For instance, Greta Thunberg, Jane Goodall, and David Attenborough are the number one influencers for the World Economic Forum. And there's actually a video of them marketing the Voice for the Planet, which is the sister campaign for New Deal for Nature.
So that's Corey Morningstar there taking you through this whole idea about privatizing nature, digitizing nature. She talks there about Clive Spash, his latest book, Martin. I'm not sure if you've come across it in the libraries, Foundations of Social Ecological Economics. So the idea is to create this entire market to do with the ecology.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me very much of the debates around cap and trade brought up by Aubrey Meyer when I used to work for New Economics Foundation. And he came to a weekend seminar to discuss these ideas. And I have to tell you that the main NGOs in Britain, like Friends of the Earth and Greenpeace and so on, were very unhappy with this idea that we're going to put a price on nature, and by putting a price on it, we'll make companies, because they're pursuing their profit motive, we put a price on nature, therefore that will solve the problem. Because, of course, it's a way of getting round the issue that maybe the government's got to solve the problem and the corporations are the problem.
In 2010, he brought out a book called Post-Keynesian Ecological Economics. So he's trying to pull all this stuff apart. But when he says post-Keynesian, really, I mean, you know, you're an economist, I'm not. But I mean, what that says to me is the idea that governments are no longer going to have like capital programs. They're not really going to be spending money on infrastructure.
Yeah,
well,
the thing is that what they want to
isn't that what Keynes was?
Keynes believed in government intervention. Yeah. But what you've got with the modern World Economic Forum approach to this is corporations can become
the way to solve the problem. They've got all of these resources, and there's a kind of moderate sort of greenery where you say, well, we've got to work with the institutions, with BAE systems, with the banks to try and solve the problem. And people who just want conflict, see, the old-fashioned conflict way of trying to solve problems has got to end. We've got to cooperate, and we've all got to cooperate together to try and solve the problems by creating economic mechanisms.
You will cooperate.
Yes, we'll create an economic mechanism so that the market will solve the problem of itself.
You will cooperate.
So in other words, for example, when a company creates pollution or carbon emissions or whatever, they can offset that by buying bonds in building in creating forests.
Yeah.
And of course, this is just fundamentally wrong. If you want to stop fossil fuel emissions, the government needs to say, right, we're not going to exploit this particular fossil fuel resource. As happened in Ecuador, where they had a referendum and the people voted, we're not going to have oil exploration
because,
in our national
park. You've got a basic problem here in that a bank can just literally loan masses of money to a company to pay off its carbon doodah, and then they can do
exactly
what they want.
But the whole point is that you create a market mechanism for solving the problem rather than saying, hang on a minute, this corporation is making a mess. They need to be fined, possibly need to be bankrupted. Maybe the government needs to take it over.
These people are pretty good at fixing markets, like Apple, for example, monopolising
them. That's right. So the whole point is there's got to be a market solution. Then there isn't one. In actual fact, lots of problems are not market solution friendly. It's actually the government that's got to step in and say, no, we're not doing
that.
Well,
these people want to remove governments.
Well, that's right.
So
in other words, it'll all be a self-regulating mechanism, and we won't need any kind of body in charge.
They want the government's hamstrung. Anyone that's elected, they want them hamstrung. Anyway, Martin, we must move on, because there is this new documentary out this week called Climate, the Movie. I think the producer is Martin Durkin, who is also responsible for a film called Against Nature back in the 1990s, which was quite controversial, and another one in the noughties called The Great Global Warming Swindle. But anyway, let's have a listen to an excerpt from Climate, the Movie now.
People like me, our careers depend on funding of climate research. This is what I've been doing just about my whole career. This is what the other climate researchers are doing with their whole career. They don't want this to end.
If NASA said global warming's not a problem, where does their funding disappear, right? So they can't say that. I mean, you've got the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change. If they said the climate isn't changing, they'd have no reason to exist.
The IPCC has a self-preservation instinct to show that climate change is an existential threat. Otherwise, there's no reason for them to be collecting the money and doing the work in the first place.
There are not just now billions, but there are trillions of dollars at stake.
There's a huge amount of money involved. This is a huge, big money scam. A lot of people's livelihoods depend on it. They're not going to give that up.
If suddenly the notion becomes apparent that this is not such a problem, you're going to see that as an existential threat.
Scientists who studied the natural causes of climate change began to be viewed with suspicion, as two Harvard astrophysicists discovered.
How much does the sun change, and how does it change, and why does it change? And then we didn't even want to get into the temperature record climate thing. Immediately they will come after, because when we started to estimate that the sun changed by quite, you know, significantly in terms of climatic sense, immediately the attack is there. Because it's not following the narrative, because they need the CO2 to be the only one, the only dominant player.
When you try to say, well, gee, we're just looking for the background of natural variability, the response would be, we can't have natural changes as an effect. It has to be human caused. And some of that was directly stated, but most of it was indirect. Your funding for this kind of project will be dropped. This kind of project doesn't go anywhere.
By that time, anything that contradicted the narrative of global warming as a serious problem was not going to get funded.
Editors of academic journals came under pressure not to accept papers which were deemed to be skeptical of the climate crisis.
We will not publish anything that questions this. I mean, it's not something surreptitious.
Scientists who dared to point out in public that there was no climate chaos began to be sidelined and shunned.
if a scientifically qualified person stands up and says, we don't see an upward trend in the data on Pacific typhoons, well, suddenly they lose standing to address the topic of Pacific typhoons, not because what they said is wrong, but because it's off message. They can marginalize any kind of criticism of the narrative by saying, you're not qualified to talk about this because you don't support the narrative. That is then, and then having marginalized everyone who doesn't support the narrative, they can turn around and say, well, everybody who counts supports the narrative, so we must be right.
Environmental journalists ignored skeptics and instead offered headlines to anyone prepared to make the most outrageous claims and predictions about a climate apocalypse.
It's gotten to where it has nothing to do with the science anymore. It doesn't matter if your alarmist prediction doesn't come true, you're still going to retain your status as an expert, and the media is still going to come and ask you for your opinion, even though you were crazy wrong about your predictions.
But the consensus on climate is not only enforced by those in the climate industry. To explain the broader appeal of the climate alarm, we must look at the politics behind climate. From the start, the climate scare was political. It came from the environmental movement, the sworn enemy of free market industrial capitalism.
Finally, we've got them. We can claim that it is the free markets who are destroying the planet, and we need big government to save us.
The climate problem, it is said, stems from the irresponsible actions of greedy, feckless individuals who have too many babies and drive too much and consume too many products, and of the capitalist corporations who pander to their whims. The solution is for government to have greater power to regulate private companies, but also to guide and reshape the lives and habits of individuals.
Policy agenda has sprawled into micromanaging everybody's lives on the most minute detail, what kind of stove you can use, what kind of heater you can have, how much you can set the thermostat out, where you can drive, what kind of car you can't. According to the planners, we're not going to have internal combustion engines an hour from now.
All of these things require the government to get involved, right? Because the government has to sort of force changes upon the public. If it was up to the public, we wouldn't be buying electric vehicles because, you know, they're impractical.
So that's an excerpt from Climate the Movie just out. This is really pulling it apart, Martin. I think a lot of this, a lot of people who have been cancelled are because they're not coming up with the right ideas, apparently.
Yeah, and I think, of course, you know, what I would pick up on that little clip is this idea that what people fear is that big government is going to stop the corporations doing what the corporations want to do. I think the corporations are behind both, you know, destroying the environment and pretending to do something about it. That's exactly the game.
Well, there is.
So, in other words, it's not actually the government that's causing the government's control by the corporations are pushing this idea that they need the government to tell the corporations to do.
Well, this is sounding a bit like corporatism.
Well, it is corporatism, and of course, the tension is with some of the people who are critical of climate change. They're critical of big government, and they see this as big government stepping in to do this, that, and the other, instead of allowing the good old corporations to just carry on doing what they want to do. I think the real issue is that places like China, where the Communist Party of China is in charge of policy, they will decide what they're going to do about climate change, and the corporations will damn well do as they're told.
It's rather different, isn't it?
Yeah. Their policy, the corporations are actually owned by the government as well.
Their policy is rather different to the British policy, isn't it? Well, corporatism is fascism.
Well, yes. I mean, what's the real issue for me at the moment is that in actual fact, there's no point us talking about having any policy on climate change if we're going to go to war and blow the planet up with nuclear weapons.
Well, do you think it's
unless we can get agreement with the Chinese, there's nothing to talk about.
A distraction?
It's not a distraction. It's but what they've done is the World Economic Forum representing the Western deep
states. All these activists are now in exile. They're not in the Stop the War movement, are they?
Well, no, because that's right. In other words, the big threat is climate change, not the fact that we're all going to go to war. And I mean, 500,000 young men have died in the Ukraine.
and a war that shouldn't have been fought. Greta Thunberg turns up and tells Zelensky, win the war and then we can save the planet from climate change. Hang on a minute, Greta. 500,000 people have died in a war that shouldn't have been fought. I mean, people of young people like you surely should be speaking out about that. You should be speaking out about the fact that the Prime Minister of Sweden was murdered by NATO. Why are you going into NATO? Now, of course, what's happening is Greta Thunberg is steering radical youth in a direction where they worry about climate change.
Yeah.
And what's really about are worrying about them. What's going to happen to me when the weather gets bad? In actual fact, they should be thinking about, what about the kids in Gaza? Are we going to go to war with Israel? Yes or no?
Well,
we went to war with Serbia. We're going to war with Russia. Maybe we should go to war with Israel. That's not the way that Greta thinks, is it?
I'll put a long version of that documentary, Climate the Movie, up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But also, just looking at the sort of more locally, and this is all about the privatisation of nature. What about the privatisation of Cirencester Park? I don't know if you've come across this story, Martin. In Cirencester,
I did see about it, yeah.
Lord Bathurst has decided he's going to charge. He's going to have a little electronic charging and give the local school kids tickets so that they can pay to walk across the park in central. Well, it's not quite there. It's not absolutely central in Cirencester, but it's a massive place that people have been walking around for hundreds of years.
I actually went on holiday and walked in that very park. Well, I mean, the fact is that Lord Bathurst owns that land, and he probably got it from the Norman Conquest, and it's his land, and if he's going to charge for it, he's going to charge for it.
So maybe we should take it off him. Yeah, maybe we should.
Maybe the Saxons should kick the Normans out, and that's our land, actually.
Last Sunday, I'm not sure, there was a massive mass trespass, the sort of thing I should go to, really, on Cirencester Park, and Lord Bathurst was interviewed by the BBC.
Why, after 300 years, as you say, without having to pay, is now the time to introduce this paying?
The landscape parkland is coming to what one might call the end of its life. The first stretch of the avenue, actually, the horse chestnut trees really should be coming down. We started taking some down in 2019. We're going to be taking more down in September. We're replanting behind that, but further on up in the avenue, the beech trees that made up much of the avenue have come to the end of their lives. They were planted 320 plus years ago.
Why should the public, I suppose is a question, be the ones who are helping to fund this?
There are some huge costs involved and some assistance for those people that enjoy walking in the park. I don't think is totally unreasonable. It's not a huge amount. You go to the arboretums or National Trust properties, you'll be paying an awful lot more.
What about the question of, as you say, this has been in place for hundreds of years, and one of the leaders of these protests says this breaks a kind of social contract for local people who have been able to have free access for centuries.
They still can. A £10 deposit, I don't think it's totally unreasonable. You know, when the park was opened originally 300 plus years ago, Cirencester and the community was very much smaller, and people are coming from further and further afield. There is more wear and tear on the environment, and somewhere that needs to be looked after and reinstated.
What do you say then to folks who say, well, look, Lord Bathurst has got quite a few pennies, he should be able to do this himself?
It's going to cost a little bit more than quite a few pennies, I can assure you. You know, there are huge costs on the estate. I keep on being told, oh, well, there's cost of living, as if the estate has got some form of immunity to the cost of living. Our costs have rocketed as well, just as much as anybody else's has.
One other point that's been raised by these protesters is the question of children needing photo ID and the question of whether kids actually will be losing these photo IDs and that will make it more difficult for them to get through and complicate going to and from school. What do you say to that?
I don't think the photo IDs are going to be come into force. It would be just the card that they will have. My answer to it is that they should learn to look after their card. They do seem to manage to do it with their mobile phones. They always seem to have them.
Yeah, well, so charging to go in the local park, a bit of it. I mean, this is, again, it's just privatisation.
Well, it's not privatisation because he owns it. So it's already been owned by
him.
He's
saying, oh, I need the money to help cut the trees down. Well, actually, he's absolutely loaded. I mean, if he really wanted to, of course, he could set up a little cafe or something in the park where people, and that would pay for it itself.
Well, maybe we should just take it off him, Tony. and then we could run it our own way, but that meant the government would have to subsidise the chopping down of the trees and all the rest of it. But we could do that by raising inheritance taxes.
The actual fact, the whole only this has been reported, is he had an acrimonious divorce about a decade ago, and it's cost him an absolute fortune, so he's got to try and squeeze as much as he possibly can out of his estate, and he doesn't want to sell any land.
Well, that's right. And, of course, maybe, as I say, I mean, the point is, why has he got this land in the first place? As he points out, the National Trust has taken over many of these kinds of
rubbish, sorry. But the National Trust doesn't own parks in the middle of towns and charge people to go
in. No, it owns all sorts of things, Tony, as you well know.
But this is because this is a local town. Kids go through
on
their way to school.
For the last
sort of
300
thing.
Years, everybody's walked across the park without having to pay, and he's allowed them to do it. Now, That should continue, in my view, but you can see, as a private landowner, he is basically, if he wants to do that, it's very hard to stop him. We need a revolution in this country, actually, Tony. All of that land ought to belong to everybody and not to him. It should be land nationalisation. That's what I've always been in favour.
I quite agree, and actually then it can be just divvied up to everybody, and nobody then has to pay mortgages
it up,
or rent.
It will be run by the community for the community.
Redistributed. I mean, you could see Ken Loach's Land and Freedom and get an idea of how to manage land. Breaking news, Kate, Princess of Wales, says she has cancer and is undergoing chemotherapy. Well, I wonder about that too. I always question these things, because I've known personally several people who've been diagnosed with cancer that then it turned out not to have cancer. And actually it was the treatment that was extremely bad for them. So I think I hope that she's had second, third and fourth opinions from outside the royal circle. So before our break, a poem from Patrizia Opulenza about our marvellous Mayor Marvin Rees. On podium, Marv loves to stand, bleating on about the man. Me, myself and I, he drones, compares himself to all life's moans. With a race aplenty, Marv identifies a man of woke, 'tis no surprise. Pity me, his subplot looms, believing he can read the room. Out of chaos, Marv loves to speak. How he reached the greasy peaks to the top, Marv knew was headed, correct, politically embedded. Big for his boots, this mayor became, made fun of anyone who came within a foot of Marv's smug face, disdain of anyone who chased Rees to answer for his rules. Fool guys, his team, for him, were fools. On Bristol, read the Riot Act. How slavery this place impacts. Perhaps 'tis why so much has gone. Buildings, statues, to right the wrongs. Achievement list Marv read on stage. Long as his arm made some enraged. Of things he'd done, or so he says, in the end 'twas Marvin's way. Climate strange. Top of his list. His weffy pals made sure of this. Single-handed Marv seems has fought. Plandemic, jabs, cutbacks, seems fraught. Woes of the world piled on his back, but Marv the hero has the knack of pity me, a hero sees, while fending off austerity. Infrastructure, end of life, on high rise, Marv has thrown the dice. Old buildings out, skyscrapers nice. History gone will pay the price. Me, myself, the mayor droned on, the big I am, 'tis never done. The suit of mayor once said too big, Marv's busting out to find a new gig. My way or the highway schemes, while stomping on the city's dreams. Stack 'em high, watch 'em fall. The US of A, Marv's name may call. Hobnob with snobs and the glitterati. Marv the mayor, he loves a party, where he can stand and talk all night on how he banged Bristol to rights. The highs, the lows, the days, the nights, where Marv, he wrestled with wrongs and rights. Sleepless nights, unshaven face, how to keep his plates in place. Too many balls to juggle, saw Marv the mayor, just wanted more of the same, more fame, more glory, so he could write his book, his story, on rising star from nowhere came, yes, Marv the mayor, who played the game. Soon out of reach, no longer blame, past mistakes in Bristol's name. Marv, his duty now done and dusted, very soon, no more be busted. A suit of armour in woke he wears, culture wars, a divisive snare. His duty done, UN jet awaits, while weffy mates seal Marvin's fate.
Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for what is right, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted in the cause of right, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people abuse you and persecute you and speak all kinds of calumny against you for my sake. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward will be great in heaven, as it was for the prophets persecuted before you. In your prayers, remember your Father knows what your needs are before you ask Him. This is how you should pray. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil.
And so, as you, Lord, have shown us every kindness, we dare to ask you for mercy for the brokenness and evil in our world. For people terrorized and hounded from their homes by powers motivated not by love, but by fear. Lord, have mercy. For people facing hunger, people unable to access health care and the means of life. Lord, have mercy. For people and animals unable to thrive because of pollution, Lord, have mercy. For governments and decision makers at every level of human society, we pray for wisdom, integrity, and justice, for courage to stem corruption and uphold the rule of law. Lord, have mercy. For people persecuted because of their faith, their desire for justice and truth. For those who oppose corruption and abuses of power in every place. Lord, have mercy. Make us servant-hearted people of love, uncowed by threats, committed to justice and peace, equality and inclusion because of your eternal love, that we may be a blessing and a sign of your faithfulness in every generation.
So that's Massive Attack from 1998 with Teardrop, Bristol local Bristol band. And before that, we heard The Beatitudes from Jesus of Nazareth, which is the film which Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice wrote back in the 1970s. And we had a little prayer from, I think that one was from the Daily Service earlier on this week, in between that. Anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Martin, do you want to say a little bit about, you were sort of elbowing me during the break there about the Russian elections?
Well, obviously, as you say, we did cover this last week, but of course he did win, as expected. And what was very interesting was the turnout, because, of course, the West wants to suggest that he's got not popular and all the rest of it. There were a higher turnout, the highest turnout ever in a Russian presidential election, 11 percentage points higher than the highest high turnout in the last presidential election in the United States. And although people who turned out, 87% voted for him, and the West is going, that's because it's not really a fair system. People voted for Putin in Russia because the country's at war and they want to rally round the flag and they want to win the war. And they also know that he's, you know, their living standards as a result of Western sanctions have actually improved. And that's, you know, their economy grew by several percentage points this year, unlike Western European economies like Britain. So you can see why he's won and why Sunak's going to lose and why Biden's possibly going to lose, why Macron will probably lose. It's just, there's just no contest.
I suppose we ought to, I mean, just mentioned this news that's just broken an hour ago about Kate Middleton, the Princess of Wales, her announcement about cancer. A 2-minute video message was recorded by Catherine on Wednesday by BBC Studios, a production arm of the BBC. BBC News, which is separate from the studios, was briefed on the announcement this afternoon by Kensington Palace. Royal correspondent Sarah Campbell says the BBC had no editorial involvement in the message and made no edits to the statement. Well, good. What do you make of this announcement? You know, it's bizarre, isn't it? We're just within a few months, Charles and Catherine have got cancer, apparently.
Well, I mean, we don't know the background to this other than what we've been told. It's very sad when a young woman like that who's in the prime of life gets cancer, if that's what's happened to her.
Well,
I wish her well.
I worry enormously about these things because there's so much control over messaging that's coming out from the royal family. In a way, it's almost like it's being run as some sort of corporate spin machine. Key fact here is that we've got in the background these amazing cancer therapies are being prepared, so-called vaccines with gene editing sort of software involved in them. And also, of course, I won't say of course, but I had a very close mate who was involved in the film industry, used to do security. Well, it wasn't maybe that close, but it was someone that I trusted immensely and got on incredibly well with. He was one of the security people on the latest couple of Johnny English films. And he was diagnosed with cancer, found himself in having treatment, and after about a week or so, or 10 days in hospital being treated, he felt that the treatment was actually killing him. So he decided, I'm just going to discharge myself from here. He went after about another 2 or 3 weeks, he went for a completely separate diagnosis, and they said, oh no, you haven't got cancer, there's no problem at all here. I don't know what they were talking about. I can't remember what type of cancer it was he had, but I mean, it seemed bizarre to me that if he's got cancer after just a couple of weeks of treatment, it's all suddenly cleared up. But he felt that the treatment itself was killing him. So this is, again, we're going back to the pharmaceutical industry with the spin machine. Who knows, you know, whether or not either of these two have actually got cancer. I just wish them both well. Back to the big stuff today, which is the UN Security Council, Martin, isn't it?
Well, you said this afternoon that you'll have to tell me what exactly happened. I was working this afternoon. I had no chance to look at the news, so I have no idea what exactly happened.
Well, there's been a vote at the UN Security Council about a Gaza ceasefire, voted against by China and Russia, because they believe you cannot tie a ceasefire to release of the hostages by Hamas.
Okay, well, I mean, I imagine they would do that, because, of course, what's been happening is that every time they've put forward a call for a ceasefire, it's the US that has vetoed it, with the British abstaining. Now they've come up with their own version of a ceasefire, but Hamas have got to hand over all the hostages, but they call them hostages. Many of them are in fact prisoners of war, and of course the Israelis are holding thousands and thousands of Palestinians, and they have been for years. Marwan Barghouti, who is the Nelson Mandela of the Palestinian struggle, he's been in prison for 20 years. He was beaten up by the Israelis in prison. He's been put in solitary confinement. Apparently he's now been very savagely beaten. He's 65 years old. He could die as a result of this treatment. And of course he would be a key figure if there was going to be some kind of serious negotiation towards a two-state solution.
Israel apparently will invade Rafah no matter what the US thinks, we're told.
Well, I mean, what the West is trying to do now, as we talked about the Gaza pier, that was discussed. That's Netanyahu's idea. The idea is that the pier will allow the Israeli army to shove people onto ships, and then, yeah, guess what? They're all going to end up in rubber dinghies crossing the English Channel, because that's what they want the Palestinians to do. Just disappear, just as all the people from Syria ended up pouring into Western Europe
heard this
as a result of our attempt to overthrow Assad.
We've heard
and
this
the bombing,
this
the,
week.
The destruction of Iraq, Afghanistan. We destroy all these places, and then we're surprised there's some refugees. The Israelis are creating a Palestinian refugee problem, and it's going to be the Italians and the Greeks who are going to deal with it.
So you think there's going to be loads of Palestinians left after all this, do you?
Well, ultimately, the strategy of the Israelis, it seems to be to kill as many as possible, then send them all to Cyprus on the ships, and possibly then on to Italy, Greece, and then on to the English Channel. Because, after all, I mean, Britain used to be the imperial power in what is now Palestine and Iraq, and we invaded Afghanistan three times. We end up with those people turning up here.
So back to the UN. China and Russia used their veto power at the UN Security Council to kill a US-sponsored resolution that said there was a need for an immediate ceasefire, with other countries arguing its language was watered down. The US previously rejected a series of resolutions that demanded a ceasefire. On Friday today, the Security Council voted 11-3-1 on the resolution, with Russia and China choosing to veto it. Algeria, the primary sponsor of prior ceasefire resolutions, also voted against the motion. During her remarks to the Security Council, US Ambassador to the UN Linda Thomas-Greenfield said that Washington wanted an immediate and sustained ceasefire in Gaza. However, critics of the US resolution say its text doesn't give Israel a green light to continue its onslaught. But, you know, as I said also just now, the Israelis themselves will invade Rafah. That's what Netanyahu is saying.
Well, that's right. And of course, by what the West will then say is, well, we tried to get a ceasefire, but we couldn't get one, and now we can't do anything about it. They could pull the plug on the Israeli genocide tomorrow. They just need one phone call from Biden to Netanyahu saying, you stop or we're going to cut off your arms supply. And of course, that would actually, if Biden was a serious democratic politician in the US, he could beat Trump on that, because he could say Trump wants to go to war in the Middle East to help the Israelis. As a democratic president, we're not doing that. We're going to read the Riot Act to Israelis. That would basically rally his own base to beat Trump. But he won't do it, because the funding for US politics is run by the Zionist lobby, which is, of course, funded by the US taxpayer. And then the British just go along with whatever the Americans want. That's what we do. That's all we do.
Ron Dermer, former ambassador to the US, says Israel will take control of the city of Rafah, even if the entire world turns on Israel, including the United States. Israeli Strategic Affairs Minister Ron Dermer has vowed that Israel will invade the southern Gaza city of Rafah, even if it causes a rift with the United States. The Times of Israel has reported on Thursday any Israeli attack on Rafah would incur huge civilian casualties, since 1.5 million Palestinians are packed into the city, which has a pre-war population of only 275,000. Israeli officials claim they have a way to protect civilians, but the US has said Israel has not presented any plan. Now, this seems to me is that they're cooking up an absolutely enormous human sacrifice for Easter.
Well, it's not called Easter, it's called, Yom Kippur.
Passover.
Or whatever.
Passover.
Passover. Well, I mean, this is intolerable. What's going on now with the starvation and all
that? It is turning the Holy Land into hell. That is what they're about.
Well, that's exactly what's happening. But, of course, what may happen if they do that is you may find that Hezbollah have said, if you attack Rafa, we are going to go to war with you. We don't want to, because obviously it's very destructive for us and for the people of Lebanon. But if you do that, we've been holding back so far, we're going to attack you. And, of course, they're also talking about attacking Lebanon. The purpose of this is to draw the British and the Americans into fighting Hezbollah, just as we're already fighting Ansar Allah. And this should be the major issue in the general election in this country, as I'm sure George Galloway would agree. I mean, probably it's the most, the most important decision any society makes, whether to go to war with other people and kill their children, which is what it boils down to. And I think I make no apologies for suggesting that this should indeed be the issue of the general election in this country. If this government, which has already taken us to war with Yemen without a vote in parliament, takes us to war with Lebanon without a vote in parliament, they need to go. We need to get these people out. The warmongers that have run this country since the 1970s need to be given their marching orders.
Israel has bombed over 400 healthcare facilities. That's not just sent their troops in, but actually bombed them from the air, mostly. 400 healthcare facilities. The Al-Shifa Hospital, already come under attack many times. Supposedly some sort of secret base for Hamas underneath. What do you reckon to that?
I sent you an article about this earlier in the week. I don't think you probably haven't opened the email. It was about the guy. What had happened was the Hamas police chief, whose name I've forgotten, but it's in David Hurst's article on Middle East Eye, and same in Peter Oborne also picks up on this. He's the police chief for Hamas in Gaza, and what he had done is orchestrate with the various people who want to bring aid into Gaza so that they could do it in an orderly fashion. And the first lot of trucks to come through under his tutelage in an orderly fashion and an orderly distribution of aid, that was actually a bread rag to a bull to the Israelis, and they went into Al-Shifa Hospital to assassinate him, and they succeeded in assassinating him. He's the top police officer in Gaza. And, of course, he works for the Hamas government because they are the government. But they've killed him to make sure that there can't be any orderly aid delivered to Gaza. And, of course, the way it's presented in the Western media is this terrible famine in Gaza that's just being caused by the situation. It's being deliberately caused by the Israeli military.
Okay, well, I'll make
they
sure
are
I put
stopping
up a,
food going to those people.
I'll make sure I put up a link to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Thanks very much, Martin. Just this principle is that they're going into these hospitals as if there's no tomorrow. They're just sending people in.
They want to destroy the health infrastructure because they need to. The goal is to kill as many Palestinians as possible, then kick the rest out for the rest of the world to look after them. As Smotrich, I think it said, if the Irish are so friendly to the Palestinians, they can have them. Yeah, that's the policy.
Yeah, well, that certainly seems to be. In terms of the attack on Rafah, just finally.
Well, I mean, it's clearly
Easter
going
is
to
a great
be...
great time. They've waited and waited and waited right until the Holy Week to do this, haven't they?
Well, we'll have to see what the timing looks like in the end.
And they are going to do it. I think it's obvious they are going to do it.
Well, I don't think that they've made it clear that they're not going to take any notice of anybody. At that point, Biden says, "Say right, I'm cutting off your arms supply."
And so, surely,
and then Trump will say, "If I get elected, I'll put it back on."
Biden isn't going to say that. Isn't it a bit stupid of the Chinese and the Russians to veto this the Security Council?
No, they'll have their own reasons for doing this, which is because, and the Algerians, of course, have also voted against it. It's because it's basically giving the Israelis the right to decide
let's just take a bit of blue sky thinking here, man, which doesn't seem to be happening at all, which is you have a ceasefire in order to buy some time to negotiate release of prisoners, hostages, etc.
That's right. You don't start off
prisoners of war.
Ceasefires are when you just say stop shooting
And then you negotiate. Then you negotiate about what you
but
need
what
to do.
What the Americans are saying with this motion is you've got to, we're only going to have a ceasefire if you already, pre the ceasefire, agree to release the hostages, and there's no agreement from the Israelis to release the prisoners and hostages that they've
got. No agreement, and of course they're seizing more and more people to put in prison in Israel so they can use them as bargaining chips. I mentioned Marwan Barghouti earlier. He's an obvious person to be released. I'm pretty sure Hamas will be calling for his release, because if there was a presidential election in the Palestinian territories, he would probably win, because he's widely respected both in Fatah and Hamas. But they're not interested. They're basically saying Hamas has got to surrender the only card they've got. Then there can be a temporary ceasefire. And then when that temporary ceasefire is over, the Israelis can go back to killing everybody. Whereas if you say there's just going to be a
That makes sense. I understand that now. Yeah. US has told Ukraine to halt attacks on Russian energy. They woke up apparently in Ukraine this morning to having almost every power station in Ukraine knocked out by Russian missiles.
Well, what's happening there is a very steady escalation by the Russians. So they could have, you know, at any stage they could have pulverized the whole of the Ukraine, but they haven't done it. And at each stage they've escalated, and they've kept escalation dominance by not going all out. That's why they call it a special military operation, because it isn't an all out war. Whereas what the Israelis are pursuing isn't a war, it's a genocide. So, you know, there's a spectrum here, isn't there? Where civilians are killed by accident, civilians are killed where you don't care that much, and then killing civilians on purpose. Two quite different strategies.
Now, as I said at the start of the show, we're going to be looking at Sabine McNeil, an interview with her, on the Hampstead satanic ritual abuse case, where, in a nutshell, just to explain it, there was a mother who took some film of her children describing being abused by the father and a satanic gang of some sort. Now, whether or not this is true is not for us to decide, but I'm quite frustrated to see that this could be a mass miscarriage of justice. And in the documentaries and the articles that have been published over the last couple of weeks here in the UK and broadcast, Sabine has not been approached. At least she assured me that she hadn't been approached to contribute to those. It's just assumed that she's guilty. Now, she did 4 years in HM prison Bronzefield over this, and so I thought I'd give her a bit of a right to reply, since there'd been so much on the opposite side calling her the worst and most evil internet troll in the world.
Well, with this Channel 4 documentary, there's been a whole lot of coverage of this again. Just to read you out one headline from the Daily Mail: sick troll Sabine McNeil, that's supposedly you, who accused Hampstead mothers of running a satanic child abuse ring, still pleads her innocence. Well, at least that part of it's true. That's on the 11th of March, 24. A sick troll who accused mothers in Hampstead of running a satanic child abuse ring is still pleading her innocence and has compared her suffering to Jesus Christ, as she said she cannot accept the verdict. Two young siblings, aged 8 and 9, accused parents, including their own father and teacher at that North London primary school, of being part of a satanic paedophile ring involving horrendous ritual abuse in 2015. Their mother, Ella Draper, shared the false accusations online, and Sabine McNeil, a virulent conspiracy theorist, since dubbed Britain's worst online troll, released videos of the children making these accusations alongside personal details of 175 people allegedly involved. So that's what they're saying. How do you respond to that?
Well, it's just as nasty as possible. And what can I say, except it's not the truth. It's just a smear campaign.
So for anyone that's watched the documentary thinking, oh my goodness, isn't it terrible? We need to control the internet to make sure that people like Sabine don't have access to it. What would you say to them to convince them that you're right and that the Daily Mail is wrong?
Well, the internet is just a tool like a knife, and you either use it for good or for bad. And I came to London at the time with a vision of a peace network of people and computers protecting our planet. That was long before the internet was created. So I've always been fascinated by using computers for communication, and that's what I've done. I'm not a troll. I'm a web publisher. I had over 50 websites going and over 10, and at least 10 petitions at the time. A troll never uses their own name. They always use avatars. So just a conspiracy theory. I've been talking about conspiracy realities for quite some time. And I've never published the names of the perpetrators. If the police had done their job properly, they would have asked me, and that's what my nephew, who is a public prosecutor here in Germany, had said. They should have said that cease and desist after my first arrest, when that's when somebody had come forward and pointed out with the evidence that the evidence of the abuse had been published already in November or December before I had petitioned Theresa May. So, you know, it's all twisted and omitted just to paint me in a bad picture of incredulity.
Yeah. Did the Daily Mail contact you and ask you for a quote?
Of course not. I was in prison at the time.
Well, no, this is a very recent article. That's just a week ago.
Yeah, but no, they didn't contact me now either. But it just sounds like one which was published at the time of my judgment. That's what was one when there was the first campaign of character assassination. Then there was Tortoise Media. They lured me into an interview, also under false pretense, and BBC Radio 4 while I was in exile in 2015. They said they wouldn't represent me. Well, they didn't tell me the title of the interview, and which was The Cult That Never Existed. So the denial of the cult is the agenda, is the narrative. And there's a website which is called londonhasasecret.com, and they mention just two cases. One is Seville, the other one is Hampstead.
Okay, so look, take a big step back from all this if you can. What is going on? What's the bigger picture?
The bigger picture is, unfortunately, that SRA is what binds the elite. And they use it for harvesting adrenochrome. That is the real purpose. And that's it. And this adrenochrome is like a drug for rejuvenation and God knows what. But that is the purpose. They use this blood of babies, which is full of adrenaline because of the terror that they experience.
So that's Sabina McNeil speaking to me this week, giving her a right of reply, Martin. So her case is being compared to that of Jimmy Savile, the two worst cases apparently in the UK.
Well, I don't know enough about this case to say anything. I mean, I'm perfectly prepared to listen to what she's got to say. But since I don't know that much about the original case, it's hard to comment.
Yeah, and it's also, I think, I just look at it as a potential miscarriage of justice. She's been not been included in any of the coverage, and there's a documentary been made just about the court case as if she's guilty. But there is certainly some evidence that there was to begin with, the Metropolitan Police did start to investigate this, but they were lent on very heavily not to, and then to turn on the people who'd given the evidence. Of course, what this does is it discourages anybody who's witness to child sexual abuse to come forward. And we've seen this time and time again with things to do with sexual abuse particularly, but also similar kinds of crimes by the Metropolitan Police, haven't we? And these criminal officers involved in it too.
Yeah, well, I mean, sexual abuse is far wider than many people realise. You know, it is a.
It sounds here like it's organised. That's what she's saying.
Oh, yes, and of course,
very well organised.
There is, you know, what you might call common or garden sexual abuse. Stepfathers being, you know, very definitely in the frame most of the time, and then you've got what you might call high level sexual abuse, which is related to intelligence work by people like Mossad. The Epstein stuff is all about getting blackmail material on people.
That's a different level again.
Well, it could be related to this. Anyway, so I'll put the full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, along with another interview with Sabine, which is a more, you know, because I do quite a combative interview with her. I'm asking her some awkward questions there. But there's another one where she just sort of pours her heart out to say what she thinks was really going on. So I'll put both of those up tonight on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. On now to Andrew Lowney. He's a literary agent. And he's brought out a book called The Mountbatten Diaries, but he had a bizarre maneuver legal case with the University of Southampton, where the Mountbatten Diaries had been bought by the University of Southampton, but then they refused to make them available to anybody.
One of the exemptions in the Freedom of Information Act is Section 37, which is communications with basically the royal family. So anything relating to the royal family can be taken out of records and even personal records like this. And it's one of the things that FOI campaigners have been long saying, that this is ridiculous. There should be a public interest test and they shouldn't be basically given a get out of jail free card. I think what we also saw here was that Southampton had invited members of the royal household to come and vet this collection which was in effect owned by Southampton, had been freely sold by the family. If it had been sold to an American institution, for example, the whole lot would have been released a decade before. So there were no grounds really to let someone else come and poke around. So there's a lot of deference there to the royal family from this academic institution, which should be in favour of academic scholarship. But I think it just says quite a lot too about how and it's in the news at the moment, this trust relationship that one has to have with the royal family and how they curate the record. We do not get the full story because records are held back. I'm trying to write a book on Prince Andrew at the moment on his position as a trade envoy. And this was a public position paid for by the taxpayer, quite separate from his position in the royal family. And yet all the records are closed when they should by law be in the National Archives. I've discovered that any records relating to Prince Andrew will not be opened until 2065, which 105 years after his death. So there's really no opportunity to have any scrutiny of what these people are up to. I've just written a book called Traitor King about Edward VIII. And what I managed to discover there was that the former King of England was a traitor to this country and could well have been executed if they decided to take action against him because of his treacherous activities. With Mountbatten, one of the disclosures was that he had abused two teenage boys. A third one has now come forward. A boy of 12 has come forward, has got a case in the courts in Ireland. And this was all covered up. My own feeling as a monarchist is that the bad apples spoil it for everyone else. It destroys trust in an institution. And of course, it opens up, if you don't communicate properly, it opens up a vacuum for speculation, which is what we've seen with the photo and the reluctance to say what has happened to the Princess of Wales.
Well, of course, that has been cleared up today. But Martin, what about this wider point about a few bad apples in the royal family? He's actually saying, you know, he's quite fessing up, saying, well, actually, I'm a royalist, but these bad apples really need to be exposed.
Well, I'm in favour of finding out the truth about things. I mean, Prince Andrew, if he's working as a trade envoy to sell British weaponry around the world, he's an employee of the government. It's not even Prince Andrew, the prince. He's employed by the government, and we ought to know what he's been up to. But, of course, we don't know what the government gets up to because they don't want us to know, and they find various ways of preventing us from finding out, not least by locking up people like Julian Assange in Belmarsh Prison.
Yeah, so, and also one of the things he wrote about in his book Traitor King about Edward VIII was about this whole sort of campaign. He goes into a bit more detail about the campaign of Edward VIII to cooperate with the Nazis during World War II.
This is the moment in July 1940 when he's consorting with the Germans. I found Portuguese Secret Service files showing how he was in and out of the German embassy discussing this. He tried to delay his return to Britain while these negotiations were going on. And this extortion to bomb Britain also appears, for example, in some of the diaries of people who were moving in those circles, and is the was discussed in a documentary I made with the title Traitor King for Channel 4. So, I mean, these allegations are well known, well substantiated by serious historians, and yet people refuse, some historians, well, some writers refuse to believe them, when the evidence is there and has been ignored for 50 years. The Churchill threatening to court-martial the Duke in July 1940 has been in Churchill's papers for many years, and no one until really me has actually used that material, and one has to ask why.
So full interview with Andrew Lowney up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. This is, I think, amazing, really, that that we've got this treacherous royal. One of the things that that Andrew does is he compares the relationship between Edward and Edward VIII and Mrs. Simpson, the divorcee who supposedly was responsible for him being bounced out, nothing to do with the fact that he was a Nazi, of being the King of England and the abdication. He compares them to Harry and Meghan. It's almost as if Harry has been spun out by Meghan in a similar way to Edward was spun out by Mrs. Simpson.
Well, I think you've just put your finger on it in the first part of what you said. Edward VIII was a traitor to the country and a friend of Adolf Hitler. I don't think anybody's accusing Prince Harry of anything like that, even though he did wear a Nazi uniform in his youth at a party. He's basically a nitwit. Edward VIII is a villain.
And so we finally, this week, we'll be looking at David Livingstone, I think, from a few weeks ago, where he talks, well, I asked him a quite a knotty question about Luciferianism or Satanism. What's the difference? Are people one or the other? And I think we can say goodbye to you at this point, Martin, can't we?
Yes, like the bishop in a brothel, it's time to make my excuses and leave.
Okay, we'll see you next week. Good Friday, before we break for Easter.
Historically, the cultists have had a history of trying to differentiate between Lucifer and Satan, right? So you'll find that back going to Albert Pike and his Morals and Dogma. And because that's sort of how they rationalize their worship of Satan, claiming that they're not worshiping the evil Satan, they're worshiping, you know, some fallen angel of light or something like that. But that's just a con game. It is Lucifer and it is evil that they choose, you know, regardless of whatever name you call it. The thing is, you know, the devil didn't invent evil. Evil was a propensity that existed before humans or the devil himself. So, but the devil is trying to recruit as much of humanity to evil as he can. So, yeah, that's fundamentally what the difference comes down to, or the lack of difference.
Satanists themselves talk about, it's not really a religion, they say. It's like, you know, we don't really believe in a god. Yeah. We do follow ideas, satanic ideas, but really it's about the elevation of the self, the elevation of the ego.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, Satanism is like, I mean, it's like any other, I guess you could call it a religious or ideological tradition. It's got various sects and interpretations. And, you'll find many that are sort of pop Satanists that, you know, have difficulty with sort of the religious associations of Satanism. So they try to sort of secularize it. And, yeah, they provide these kinds of interpretations to excuse, their actions and free it from, biblical connotations. But it's, usually those kinds of Satanists are not really the true Satanists at the core who are at the helm, let's say.
Again, it's another onion we're looking at here. What about Nazism? Because I can remember Winston Churchill, who Dennis Wheatley thought was a member of the Illuminati, saying that this was a battle for Christian civilization going on. And I think many people in the 1939 and 1940, the early part of World War II, really yeah. did feel that there was a some kind of satanic force. So, you know, were there links, genuine links between that we can make between the Nazis and some kind of satanic idea or, you know, that level of evil?
Well, it's funny because I was just reviewing that whole topic today because, there's a book which is probably the most well-recognized book on Nazism and the occult by, Nicholas Goodrich Clark. And, it's really a whitewash. He seems to be embarrassed by any suggestion that there's an association between Nazism and the occult. Because his sort of point is that there's no sort of definitive proof that Hitler espoused any occult doctrines himself or that he was a member of the Thule Society. So that most of the claims are fanciful, which is completely ridiculous because we're talking about a movement that adopted an occult symbol, the swastika, as its flag. And, most of its outlook was derived, it's pretty clear it derived from the occult. And then, of course, most of the leading personalities of the Nazi party, particularly people like Himmler, were undoubtedly devoted to the occult. I mean, the SS was an occult organization. But what's really interesting, and this is crazy, is that even if you read Goodrich Clark's book, he shows that Rudolf von Bettendorf, who was the founder of the Thule Society, traveled to Turkey, where he learned Kabbalah from a Turkish Jewish family from Salonika. And he doesn't dispute the point. he openly acknowledges it. But of course, then he would suggest that, you know, the Thule Society had a limited influence on the Nazi party. The reality is that the Thule Society was responsible for the founding of the German Workers' Party that eventually changed its name to the Nazi Party. So they were through and through at the core the source of the Nazi movement and its ideology, which again goes back to Kabbalah. But what's important is that the Salonika in Greece was also the base of the Sabbatian movement. And so in particular, Sabbatendorf got introduced to the Sufism of the Bektashi. And the Bektashi were what happened to the Sabbatian movement is that after Shabtai Zvi converted to Islam, his followers followed him in his conversion and became a sect known as the Donmei, who exists to this day. It's a very peculiar community because they practice Islam in public, but practice Kabbalistic Judaism in secret. And so they were also responsible for the formation of the Young Turk movement, who were in turn responsible for the overthrow of the Islamic Empire in Turkey. And so this was the network that Sabbatendorf was affiliated with. What's also interesting is the close connection because the Young Turks was named after the young movements that were founded by Giuseppe Mazzini, who by several accounts was the successor of the head of the Illuminati. And he created a number of movements like Young Italy, Young Germany, Young Poland, and so on. And so the Young Turks was a variation of it. And associated with them was Zev Jabotinsky. Zev Jabotinsky, of course, whose secretary was Netanyahu's father.
I hope you caught that bit at the end there. Jeb Zagwatinsky was the secretary to Netanyahu's father. All very, very, very close and very closely examined. And I think he must scratch his head sometimes, poor old David Livingston. And well, he's not poor old. He's bless him, he's brilliant. And think, well, why aren't people picking up on any of this? Because they are occult networks, are all working very, very closely together. Seem to be absolutely obsessed with these monotheistic faiths and Gnostics, as you heard there, who are out there in public practicing. practicing, services, conducting services, running churches, mosques, synagogues, etc. But actually, behind closed doors, there's something very, very different going on with these individuals, turning actually those faiths upside down. So it's all a massive attack. If I can use that expression from our music in the middle, we might have a little bit more after the show, and a massive attack on these monotheistic faiths. So time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and to sound engineer Dave Pozanko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored if you wish on Telegram. Do please send us interviews, story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. And you could subscribe to my weekly newsletter and even donate, if you wish, at thisweekoneword.org.uk. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol, on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show on Good Friday at 5 p.m. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down. Let's check the seas.